Gentlemen, and welcome to the Board of Public Works. Today is August 21st, 2013. We have a number of items on the agenda today. And the first item, though, we have is the retirement of Marion Boschert.
No! She's the one with the big grin on her face.
After a longer tour of duty by 1 month than Lewis L. Goldstein had. So I just wanted to read you a few of the highlights from this proclamation that we'll be presenting to you right off the bat here, Marion. The history of the Board of Public Works would not be complete without reference to the legacy of the unsinkable Marion Boschert. I didn't know they called you the unsinkable. The Board of Public Works first encountered Marion Boschert when she showed up as a Kelly girl one day in 1973. Marion Boschert became a full-time permanent state employee on April 15, 1974. Marion Boschert's length of service is unrivaled at the Board of Public Works, eclipsing even a certain Lewis L. Goldstein by a month or two. Marion Boschert, in her capacity as recording secretary to the Board of Public Works, diligently and unerringly provided critical support to the Board of Public Works by scheduling board meetings, preparing agendas, related materials, maintaining board minutes and records. Marion Boschert particularly enjoyed conflicts over wetlands permits. No, I'm kidding. I threw that one in. Her perseverance, thoroughness, and most especially her good nature permitted her to chart a steady course of record keeping. And so on and so forth. You'll have a whole...
There's 7 governors, 4 comptrollers, 5 treasurers. I just want to make sure that... She served all of those governors, including the 6th one at this table right now. But Mary started with Marvin Mandel.
Wow. So how about that? That's the...
Young.
And what was that, the 10th anniversary?
No, I've won some award for a photograph I took.
Well, we're going to miss you. You've been awesome. Thank you so much, and congratulations to you. Come on up, let's do a picture.
Okay.
Come on up. We're going to push these chairs back and do a picture right quick. Nance, let me move this back. And we'll all stay in front of them. Come on in, gang. Aaron, why don't you take front and center there?
Hi, how are you?
My daughter, Christine.
Hello, Christine.
Hi.
Congratulations to you. Hold on.
Okay. Right this way, please.
Great. Marion, any words of advice?
Thank you all. Everybody has been very cooperative and friendly and did what I asked when I asked. But I appreciate it. I enjoyed working with all of you.
Yeah, we enjoyed working with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Make sure you take her out someplace nice today.
Okay.
Thank
you.
We'll see you, Marion.
Thank you.
This is going to be the best meeting ever, Marion.
The first time I saw Marion here, I was sort of taken aback because I knew that I knew her, but I didn't know her from. And it took me a while. I kept looking at a name and looking at a name. I said, Boschert. I said, you wouldn't be any relation to a colleague of mine, would you? And it turned out she was. So I think spanning all these worlds, you have been a great force for the good.
Yes, time for family now.
Mr. Comptroller?
Yes, thank you, Governor. And Marion, congratulations. I served along with the treasurer with Dave, and he's a tremendous friend of a lot of us, and delighted you're going to get some time with your family. Last week, Governor, it was Shop Maryland Tax-Free Week. It is now concluded. I had the pleasure of visiting several parts of the state, Montgomery Mall in Bethesda, the Target in Easton, Towson Town Center, and the Hagerstown Premium Outlets, with local business leaders to promote this great benefit to our citizens. As you know, it's the second busiest shopping week of the year because the legislature and you, Governor, and others created a tax-free week for back-to-school apparel and shoes. So having a break on the 6% sales tax for shoes and apparel makes a big difference. It means a lot to Maryland families and to small businesses, primarily because we take one of these weeks in the dog days of August, and through this innovative law, we catapult it. So that other than the Christmas week, it's the second biggest shopping week in the school year. And it's hard to believe, frankly, that it is so successful. I would recommend, Governor, if you're considering other ideas, to expand it next year to backpacks and other back-to-school supplies. Other states do that, and I think it would be equally well-received and successful. It's hard to believe that we're actually going back to school. Six counties across Maryland are in session this week. Students in every public school system will be back to class at the beginning of next week. For me, summer is a time for making memories as a family, for developing relationships with neighbors, for kids to learn the lessons that can't be learned in classrooms or textbooks. And for the tourism industry, Maryland's fourth largest industry that employs approximately 340,000 of our fellow Marylanders, friends, and neighbors, this isn't just about making memories or being happy, my desire to have school start after Labor Day. It's about, for many families, making payroll and being able to stay open. So I commissioned the Bureau of Revenue Estimates to conduct a study on the economic impact of starting the public school calendar after Labor Day. And this Thursday, we released the report, which indicates that this common sense adjustment would result in a $73.4 million additional direct economic activity in the state, $7.7 million in added state and local tax revenue, and perhaps most importantly, $3.7 million in supplemental wages for working Marylanders, whose wages have remained extant. Hello? Is that someone who's supportive of my proposal? I know the kids are.
You get the whistling phone. Yeah. Is that you, Miss Peggy? Miss Peggy, when did your phone start whistling? Probably paying extra for the whistle on that procurement.
Yeah.
Some story.
So the $3.7 million in supplemental wages for working Marylanders, why is that important? Because people's wages have essentially remained stagnant over the last 5 years. And this study does not include indirect or induced spending, which would make the true impact of moving this date exponentially larger. Think about that for a moment. That's nearly $75 million or $150 million, if you look at indirect costs, injected into our state's economy, back into the pockets of our citizens who have been hammered by a sluggish recovery and repeated series of tax hikes, toll increases, and fee increases. And it's almost $8 million into the state coffers to pay for our priorities like improving schools, ramping up public safety, cleaning up the bay, and upgrading our aged transportation infrastructure. And the best part of this proposal is it doesn't cost a thing. That would be a win for Maryland's families and our economy. It's a win for students who rely on summer jobs to earn money for themselves and their families. It's a particular win for small businesses that won't have to lose experienced staff in mid-August, right at the peak of the tourism season. It's a win for Maryland families who will get the chance to share special moments, create more memories, and enjoy more quality time together. And if you don't, frankly, need to take my word that it's a good idea, take a look at the online polls. I mean, not that I put a lot of credence in the thousands of people that vote on the Baltimore Sun, but I've never seen 88% of their respondents agree on anything. And they do agree that summer should be summer. So, obviously, the students I mentioned, they aren't voters, I guess, but they will be at some point. They're all in favor of it. And there's a task force that's been legislated, which I applaud, the leadership of Senator Mathias and others. And they're going to be meeting in September. And I really fervently hope that they can work out the logistics so that this common sense, pragmatic change can benefit Maryland families and small businesses and improve the health of the Maryland economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm for all of that, too. So well, hopefully the task force will come out our way on it. We've got a packed agenda.
Governor, there are a couple of things I would like to mention. No, it's all right. I hadn't given you a heads up on it. But there are two people who have passed away relatively recently whom I'd like to mention because many people here knew him, but more did not and ought to have, and then enter something in the record in commemoration of the life and the work of Mike Volk and Mike Yarbrough. Michael Volk was a fellow who came to Annapolis at the same time I did, January 1971, both working for our General Assembly. He worked for 42 years for legislative services. Mike was a staff for a number of committees. He managed staff for a number of committees. He essentially led in the integration of fiscal services and legislative services and was truly an unsung hero whom I would like to just sing for the moment and then put in the record for posterity. One of Maryland's the greatest gems, actually, I believe, is the legislative staff, the staff organization, and the members of the staff. They are actually uniquely qualified individuals, almost like a gem of a little college campus on our larger campus here, recognized throughout the nation by their peers as really the exemplars of what nonpartisan central staff should be. And Mike Volk, for all these years, was one of the premier quiet leaders. And I would just like to, I know the senator worked with him, I know the secretary did, a lot of people here did, and I only wish that more of you had, because he was really an outstanding man whom we all miss in Annapolis. And the second fellow did not work years long, only for a quarter century. Mike Yarbrough, who also passed away recently. Mike was a legislative analyst specializing in tax policy for many years for the General Assembly and also helped create new computer system to help us track policy and bill drafting. He was a very talented person, a musician, a person who had a strong private life and public, and they're just two guys who are really quite unique and who will be missed in Annapolis. So, with your permission, Governor and Comptroller, I would like to ask the Secretary just to enter into the record the story of these two unsung but now sung heroes.
Sure. Well stated. Moved by Treasurer Cupp, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it, and those memorial tributes will be recorded in the minutes of this Board of Public Works. A lot of good people
Thanks.
That work for the people.
Really, very.
Okay. We're heading into the Secretary's agenda.
This morning we have 21 items on the Secretary's agenda. Item 21 is the hand-carried item we received and already discussed. We have 10 reports of emergency procurements. We are withdrawing item 18, which will come back later. So if you have any questions on any of the other items, we have. Item 17 is a special African-American Heritage Preservation Grant. Mr. Mack is here along with Ms. Raines, I believe.
Okay. Mr. Mack, come on down.
Item 17 is a grant for the Wilson Farmstead Improvements.
Wilson Farmstead Improvement in Anne Arundel County. Mr. Mack, you have a packed audience for the Wilson Farmstead Improvement today.
Yeah, I had to use my navigational tracks to get through here. My name is Theodore Mack, known by as Ted Mack, Chair of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture. Now, wisdom in history tells me that I should not stand in the way of the linchpin of this team, so I'm going to call Ann Raines from the Maryland Historical Trust to come with the group that will make this presentation.
Good morning. I'm Ann Raines from the Maryland Historical Trust, and thank you, as usual, for giving us a few minutes to show you some of what we've been working on through the African American Heritage Preservation Program. I'm going to introduce Bill Gibbons from the West River Improvement Association. He's part of a great team in Galesville in southern Anne Arundel County. He's been working on the Wilson Farmstead Project and has a lot of other good work under their belt.
Need a bigger state house.
Good morning. Thank you, Ann. As Ann mentioned, my name is Bill Gibbons, and I'm with Jack Smith. We're both with the West River Improvement Association, which serves the village of Galesville in the southern part of Anne Arundel County. And we'd like to thank you today for you and the state of Maryland's consideration to approve $100,000 through the African American Heritage Preservation Program. These funds are going to be used to stabilize an historic building known as the Henry Wilson Farmhouse in the village of Galesville. This building is in a state of serious disrepair and has been vacant for over 20 years and is threatened with basically collapse. The building was built by Mr. Henry Wilson in 1871 and has remained in his family up until the year 2012. What makes it unique is Mr. Wilson was a freed slave and was able to acquire the funds to purchase the property and the 27.5 acres on which it sits on. And by you making these, you know, funds available to us, it's going to enable us to basically preserve and save the building, stabilize it for future redevelopment, and basically enable us to tell the story of the African Americans' economic, religious, and cultural contributions to the village of Galesville and also to all South Anne Arundel County since 1652. So we feel it's a really important project, and we really appreciate your consideration for this $100,000. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Jack Smith. I was born and raised in Galesville. I apologize for not having a necktie on, but between Bill and I, we only have one tie, and he lost. And I was, as I said, born and raised in Galesville quite a few years ago. And this is not just an African-American money that we're seeking. We're seeking it for Americans, because that's what we are down there, and we've fill out the entire range of living with whites, excuse me, and the blacks since 1652, when Galesville was properly founded. And I'm just very, very proud of Galesville. We have a different brand of people there, we think, anyhow. And we let the people in Shadyside and Deals know about it, too. At any rate, we were the first people to have an integrated school in Anne Arundel County. And that was when they built a brand-new brick school down there. It was Carrie Whedon School. And we became the people who had that privilege, I would say, and pride that we were the first integrated school in southern Maryland down there. We have a lot to be proud of. Besides that, we were the first one with the fire department, et cetera, et cetera, down that way. And I'm not here just to talk about Galesville. It's to talk about the fact that we have been very, very wide open. And the way that we have come to fruition and have been very, very good talents with both the African Americans and the white people down there. And we want you to know that we would love to have the money that Bill talks about so we could continue to turn this school down there and the property to even higher lengths. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. That was a good one. Thank you. I think we're all in favor. Mr. Mack, anything you want to say in conclusion, sir?
These projects are sometimes spellbinding because we're discovering so much that means so much to the demographics of the whole state of Maryland. So we just appreciate the opportunity to come before you to make these presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Mack, for your good work. Okay. Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Congratulations. That was a good start. How about the remaining items on the Secretary's agenda? Mr. Comptroller?
Items 8, 9, and 10.
Okay. This is Bill DeMores here. These are the Inner Harbor piers on Inner Harbor that need wetlands licenses and recommendations of compensation.
Good morning. I'm Bill DeMore, Wetlands Administrator. You had some questions, Comptroller?
Governor sat up when he said wetlands, but no, this is a good story. Mr. Moore, I really appreciate what your staff has accomplished with this proposal that's in front of us. As you know, in June of 2012, the same proposal was before us, and we were being asked to assess exorbitant levels of compensation from three businesses up in the Inner Harbor, Phillips Seafood, Dick's Last Resort, Hard Rock Cafe, in exchange for rights to expand and improve existing commercial piers situated over the Patapsco River on the Inner Harbor. And with other members of the board, we spoke out pretty forcefully against a directive that would have, I believe, as my recollection, taken hundreds of thousands of dollars out of these businesses before they, frankly, could have sold their first crab cake or cold beer. And that was a time when the economic recovery was particularly sluggish, and it was our view, or at least my view, that that amount was really going to get in the way of some needed economic revitalization. So the revised proposal that's before us now looks a lot more reasonable, and for the record, Mr. Moore, could you just remind us as to what these businesses were going to pay a little over a year ago, and how much they're being asked to pay this morning, and what steps we're taking to come up with this much more reasonable proposal?
The total amount was approximately $1.5 million for all three. And now currently we're setting compensation for Dick's Last Resort for 3,342 square feet. They're going to pay an annual compensation fee of $8,335 on it. Again, we're asking approval. That wetlands license was approved in April 20th, 2011, Secretary's item 17. Before us now are item 9 and 10, which is asking approval of the wetlands license and setting compensation. For wetlands license 120781 Hard Rock Cafe, they're asked, they have 2,160 square feet of decking. They're paying a one-time fee of $20,000. That item, as you said, was withdrawn in June of 2012. The original deck was constructed in 2000. Item 10 is 120780 Phillips Seafood. They have 4,453 square feet of decking. They're paying a one-time fee of $20,000, and then they're being assessed an annual compensation fee of $2,000. Just this summer, they increased their decking by an additional 800 square feet, which was approved by the department. And again, that item was also withdrawn in June of 2012 from the Secretary's item. And the original deck, again, was constructed in 2000. And what was taken into account here is on the Hard Rock and Phillips debt that they had already paid a mitigation back in 2000, and that the decks had been used for queuing areas. So how the fees were came about, it was negotiated with the Cordish company, and they put numbers on the table. I countered. We went back and forth for a few months, and we came to this conclusion. We do have representatives from Cordish and Phillips, if you'd like to hear from them.
Well, I just want to salute you. I think it's a very responsible outcome, and frankly, there's still a lot of difficulty out there in the economy. I was down with everyone else here in Mako for their convention recently, and I spent a lot of time talking to folks that are in the tourist business and consumers and retailers, and many of the retailers down there have been clobbered by the rainy weather that we've had this season, and the jobs that we keep wanting to come back to the state just have not appeared. I don't want to stir up DBED and have them send me a bunch of data about how well we're doing, but
I'll respond.
Let me hang on, because it's not, I'm not picking on Maryland. I'm saying the entire region has had great difficulty in bringing back obviously the kind of economic recovery that we're accustomed to. So it's really Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York, West Virginia, as well as us. The revenue data and wages and salaries are flat, and folks are employed, but they're having a hard time keeping up with rising prices, which puts a big impact on these businesses. So it just reminds me what you did today is going to permit that economic investment and expansion to move forward, and they're going to create jobs from it. Obviously, we should get compensated under state law where it's appropriate, but I wanted to just really recognize you for being smart enough to recognize that the economy needs careful review of things like this that otherwise would block economic investment. And I think you're going to add to a good climate that encourages businesses to invest capital, create jobs, and generate tax revenue. And I'm very satisfied with what you've done, and it's not easy. So happy to support this item today.
These
three items.
Thank you. Thank you. Let me just add by way of point, counterpoint, and punctuation that there is no priority for this administration more important than job creation. Without jobs, there is no progress. The latest jobs report showed that the entire region's been hurt by the short-sighted and reckless sequester that was thrown into place, supposedly against the objections of everyone in our House of so-called representatives. However, prior to that point, we had recovered 99% of the jobs that we lost in the recession. If you were to factor out those states that have a lot more minerals than they have people, Maryland's leadership in our comeback from the recession and this recovery is pretty striking. Last year, we achieved the best rate of new job creation of any state in our region, a rate of job creation that was nearly twice that of our neighbors, good neighbors, in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So while Maryland bashing may be popular in some circles, the fact of the matter is that it was not anyone on this panel that made the determination, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who named us the number one state for innovation and entrepreneurship. There were third parties that ranked us in the top three among the 50 states for upward economic mobility for hardworking families. So we do indeed have a long way to go before we restore that balance of a middle class whose wages are growing and whose children's prospects are growing at the same pace as the prior generation. But one should also be aware of the fact that we are a state that is leading in this recovery, not a state that is lagging in this recovery. And it's due in no small part to the better choices we've made together, including the 57,000 jobs that will now be supported, rebuilding our transportation infrastructure in the years ahead, the jobs we supported in the construction, hard-hit construction trades all through this recession, in our record investments in public school construction and renovation, and also the big investments we've made in our water and wastewater infrastructure, investments that have been made at both the county levels and also at the state level. So anyway, just wanted to share that perspective without minimizing the amount of work still ahead of us.
I'm going to focus like a laser on the Dover Bridge, which, Governor, you announced, which I think is terrific. A wonderful statement that you made about starting school after Labor Day and my own upcoming vacation. And so I am delighted to not respond and look forward to it in September.
Thank you for that. All right. What do we have now? What's next on the agenda? We're still on the Secretary's agenda. Mr. Comptroller?
Item 13.
This is the Comptroller's favorite part of the agenda. Item 13.
Item 13 is the Green Turtle grant of general obligation bond proceeds in Towson. I think Secretary Skinner is here, and at least Ms. Carol Gilbert from
Secretary Skinner, last time we were here, this issue came up and it was deferred. The Comptroller and the Treasurer had questions about the criteria that HCD uses for its community redevelopment efforts. Some parts of our state have to redevelop their older communities. It doesn't happen simply by wishing that it would happen. Evidence, Silver Spring, where this state invested hundreds of millions of dollars to revitalize a downtown center. In this case, we have a Maryland franchise, locally owned, called the Green Turtle, which has gotten all sorts of attention, and wanted you to tell us what this is about, what the policy rationale is for this program, and why this is an investment that, from your perspective as Secretary of Housing and Community Development, you believe that this is a good loan.
First of all, let me say good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. Delighted to be here this morning. I want to be fairly brief, but I really wanted to follow up on some of the issues that the Governor mentioned since the last meeting, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. First of all, since the last meeting, you received a strong letter of support from County Executive Kamenetz. His letter indicates that the Green Turtle is located in one of the county's commercial revitalization districts, that in that area, and particularly along York Road, that more than half of the storefronts in the 500 block of York Road where the Green Turtle is located are in fact vacant. And the county executive also indicated that the loan to the Green Turtle is really a key component of their efforts to stabilize the area, as well as attract new businesses to this particular section of York Road. As you know, there's a lot of new development going on around the area, but these particular blocks of York Road have been challenged, and as indicated by the vacancies there. Now, there are several representatives from the county here today. If you have any questions specifically about their revitalization plans and efforts, the county chief administrative officer, Sam Mox, is here. The planning director, Andrea Van Arsdale, is here, as well as director of legislative affairs, Yolander Winkler. You also received letters from the owners of the Green Turtle, kind of explaining their particular situation and why this loan is necessary as part of the total financing package to expand their business and to attract additional customers. As their letters indicate, the owners are local residents who are very active in the community. They support numerous local youth athletic teams and other charities in the area. In fact, the three owners, William, Jill and William Paco and Jeff Geiger, are also here today if you have any questions for them. So, again, in the effort to be brief, I just want to just briefly reiterate why DHCD supports this loan. First and foremost, the Green Turtle expansion is an eligible project, and it meets all of the criteria for the Neighborhood Business Works program. It's in what we call a sustainable community area that was recommended by the county government and then approved by the Smart Growth Subcabinet. It will expand an existing business and create an additional 26 jobs, which is one of the criteria of the program. It's part of a financing package that includes private bike financing and a loan from the county, as well as a borrower equity, which is, again, a requirement of the program guidelines. The necessary collateral is provided. The county supports the efforts, as I just mentioned, particularly, again, the county supports the revitalization of the Towson, what they refer to as the Towson Business District, which is a larger area, but specifically the 400 and 500 blocks of York Road are in, you know, very specific need of revitalization, and the county is focused on that. And again, the county strongly supports the project by including its own financial assistance. Finally, the other financing that I talked about, the bank and the county loans, are contingent on DHCD's loan. So, but for the DHCD loan, this project could not move forward and we could not get the additional job creation. So in summary, we believe that the loan to the Green Turtle is really no different from the other NBW loans that have been approved over the years. In fact, since 2007, we've made loans to about a dozen restaurants in different parts of the state, including Cambridge and Salisbury and Silver Spring, Wheaton, Tacoma Park, and Baltimore City. And I might add that all of those loans are current on their loan repayments. So, for all those reasons stated, I believe.
Tacoma Park?
I'm sorry.
What was the one in Tacoma Park?
I believe that was Roscoe's Pizzeria.
Uh huh. And what was the one in Silver Spring?
Silver Spring. We have Firehouse. We took an old historic fire station and turned that into a restaurant. Right.
Key Corner. Right. What was the one in?
Cambridge, we've done a couple of loans in Cambridge. Most recent is it's a bistro. And Wheaton, we did the, Wheaton was the Limerick Pub, I believe.
Oh, hell, I'm a favorite.
Yeah. And most recently, we actually did a loan to a restaurant in Ocean City, which is a part of a mixed-use project that includes a restaurant on the ground floor and apartments above for summer youth workers.
Okay. Any other criteria? You want to go right to questions?
I'm ready to answer questions.
Okay. Is there one slide we should be bringing up here?
Yeah. No, we did. Well, some of the slides, on the slides we showed
the history. How about, is there anyone that has the policy?
There are a couple. Go back, Kevin. Go back again. Back again. These are really the things that we look for in approving the loan, strengthening neighborhood, significant upgrades, and so forth.
Gotcha. We'll leave that one up while we have our discussion. Mr. Okay. Comptroller?
Thank you, Governor. And Secretary, thank you for that presentation. I think my reservations about this particular project are pretty well known. I don't want to go back over what we talked about at the last agenda, but I would like to ask a couple of follow-up questions. One, you mentioned a briefing memo from your agency. My understanding is that in its, I guess, enthusiasm for this project, that memo from your Housing and Community Development Department happened to paint an exceedingly gloomy picture of downtown Towson. It dismisses most of the economic revitalization that's already well underway in Towson as
activity that's happening on the outer edges characterizes the York Road corridor as something of a ghost town, and I quote from your memo, old suburban buildings that have not aged well, absentee landlords, changing markets, and stiff competition from outlying areas. I guess my first question, given this description of downtown Towson, how have so many other restaurants managed to cut through the apparent economic desolation and emerge as one of the most vibrant dining destinations in the entire Baltimore region? I'm thinking of places that I've visited, like Cafe Troia, which is located less than a quarter mile from the Green Turtle, Allegheny Avenue. I'm thinking of 7 West Bistro Grill, wonderful spot that serves up some of the better crab cakes in town. It's perched on the West Chesapeake Avenue, just about a block from the Green Turtle, or an 18-second drive on MapQuest if you're wondering how quickly to get over there. Other restaurants on Allegheny Avenue, less than a quarter mile from Green Turtle, and one that I visited just last week, an opening for the Oyster Bay Grill, a beautifully appointed seafood restaurant on Joppa Road. I was honored to be at that opening. I'm definitely going back with my wife. Sorry about the restaurant reviews, but here's an excerpt from a story that ran just last month with the slightly more sanguine headline, Green Turtle Riding on Wave of Upgrades. That was the title. And the article goes on to say, quote, from the roof of the Green Turtle on York Road, co-owners Jill Paco and Jeff Guidera have a great view of the changes coming to downtown Towson. Just a block away to the east, the framing for the Cinemark movie theater at Towson Square is rising above the building's underground parking structure. This is a quote. Across the intersection, the Towson Road Project will replace storefronts and a parking lot with skyscrapers. So, I think that the memo may have exaggerated the situation in its desire to be an advocate for this project. If your concern, as I understand it from your comments, is that the renaissance that's going on in downtown Towson will result in an influx of well-heeled national chains that could elbow the smaller locally owned businesses in Towson out of town, then I can respect that. That kind of makes sense. I've certainly heard those concerns from people up in Towson who are excited about the new restaurants, but also concerned about the impact on the local small businesses. But if the state truly feels that there's an imperative public interest that is served by lending taxpayer money to the Green Turtle, okay, I can see having that discussion. I might even change my mind. It's a plausible project for DBED, the Department of Business and Economic Development. But it's not a plausible project for your agency and this particular budget. Now, given the focus that appears to be on the preservation of individual business as opposed to jump-starting an economically more abound community, which Towson is not, why wouldn't this be a DBED project rather than a neighborhood revitalization project? Or maybe it should be the Maryland Industrial Development Financing Authority, designed to encourage private sector financing and economic development projects that are located in priority funding areas. Or the Small Business Development Financing Authority, which exists to provide financing for small businesses that aren't able to qualify for traditional financing. Your program is designed historically to provide seed money financing for struggling businesses and struggling downtown communities. Governor mentioned Silver Spring. That was a blighted area before the state came in. I appreciate the investments you've made in Cambridge. I think that's a perfect struggling community that needs neighborhood revitalization. So a few of my favorite things, terrific. Jimmy and Sook's down in Cambridge on Ray Street, great. Great investments. Desperately needed. Booster shot from the state. But when the Baltimore County Executive calls Towson. Baltimore County's Bethesda. Think of that. Baltimore County's Bethesda. Treasurer knows very well how successful Bethesda is. Does Bethesda have maybe a 300 block of Cordell Avenue that's a little bit, down on its stuff? That's okay. Yeah, I understand that. Does Towson have maybe a block or two that is struggling? But putting your agency's money in Bethesda or putting it in Towson is just not a good match. And that's why I'm going to vote against this project. You don't have a lot of money, and it's crucial to areas like Cumberland, Cambridge, Elkton, and other areas around the state that are not going through the economic revitalization renaissance that's happening right now in Baltimore County's Bethesda. I mean, we're sending coal to Newcastle here with these dollars. And
but didn't you object to the one in Cambridge, too?
No, I objected to the misuse of this agency's mission. On that agenda item, Governor, I supported strongly a $500,000 grant for downtown Cambridge on Ray Street for a building that was being turned in very successfully into a retail operation. I voted against giving taxpayers money to a Popeye fast food franchise out on Route 50.
That was the one.
And
that was in Cambridge, right?
And
the yes, mayor was here to testify for it.
Let me just repeat, because that's a very good point you brought up, Governor.
Is it the location that you, because I've seen you vote for some locations and against some in other locations. Is it the locations, or is it that you don't believe we should do anything on food franchises, or is it, I'm just trying to understand what the policy, because it seems that you have not a disagreement with the fact that this loan is not out of line with others that we have done in other places around the state, but you seem to have a policy disagreement that focuses on the actual use, like a restaurant. Do you think a restaurant, should they, is that your thrust? I'm just trying to understand. Is it geography?
The thrust is we have a mission for this neighborhood business redevelopment program. It's a very important mission to jumpstart revitalization in struggling communities. Bethesda is not a struggling community. Towson is not a struggling community. If a business needs some kind of public support, they should go to the Economic Development Agency and ask for it. But these are, the total budget is what, Mr. Secretary, $4
million? About $4 million, yes.
Yeah. Those are incredibly important dollars for an area like downtown Cambridge. When they're spent on a Popeye's out on fast food mile on Route 50, which technically may be within the borders of Cambridge, that is a misuse of your agency's budget for the mission that it was created. And, yeah, I voted against that, but I have nothing against restaurants. I have nothing against the Limerick Pub. What my concern is that this is mission creep where we're using your money in areas that are underway with their own economic renaissances. And God knows there are dozens of communities around the state that I have visited that have boarded up vacant stores on their main street and have nothing even close to Towson's revitalization on the horizon. And so it's a vote against Mission Creek more than Mission, more than geography, Governor. And, I don't mean to get hot under the collar about it, but when you go around to these towns in Maryland, and you see the impact of this recession on these main streets, and you see what can happen with Cambridge, which is a very successful revitalization of Ray Street, and you see something like this.
So your objection is the but-for analysis. You believe that there's no need for this, that it could have happened without any state help.
No, what I'm saying is that this is an example of a mismanaged state budget that is creeping with its mission into areas that are better left to other economic development funds within the state.
But which ones?
I mentioned three or four of them in my questions, and it is much, that is a much better
fit. So your objection
fit.
Is not to the state dollars being used, but state dollars being used from this community redevelopment program for redevelopment in communities like Towson?
Correct, because it was designed
so
for struggling communities.
It's not the tax, that it's taxpayer dollars, it happens to be this program.
Correct.
You wouldn't have an objection were it taxpayer dollars from another program.
Correct.
Okay. So, Madam Treasurer, you have any questions?
Yeah, I do. I just want to say I'm the one who stopped this 2 weeks ago, and I don't know how we all feel about that now. But I did have I did have some serious questions, and I must say, if we're going to sit as a sort of an Uber board looking at these projects, it seems to me from the very beginning we should have the information and the context, including the purpose of the program, the process of the program, how a particular project fits in with a neighborhood redevelopment, and not have to pull it out of the county or the state ourselves. If we had had, candidly, the information that we now have 2 weeks ago, I may not have raised my hand. I did go to Towson and went around the area in the last day, and I really appreciate it. I recognize that that area, the downtown Towson York Road area, in fact does have serious problems. It is in the midst of large redevelopment projects aided by public and private sources. That a good portion of the block, a couple of blocks where the Green Turtle is, have vacant storefronts, which have been vacant for a long time. It is a neighborhood. I now understand that. I understand. I had exactly the same question the comptroller had, which is, I don't have any problem with aiding a particular, especially if it's a loan and we're going to get money back plus tax spinoffs and employment from a particular project, but that's an economic development project. This is a neighborhood revitalization program. I now see this project within that context, thanks to your department and to the county. But I would ask, if we get more of these, let's get this all laid out in the beginning so that we don't have to go through that process. I have to say that I now understand how this project does meet the criteria. I think it will. I think there's a lot more that has to be done besides that project, and that was one of the questions of how it fits in with the total redevelopment. And even things like the timing, whether this is really a bridge for that downtown community to get it through the building of all the huge edifices around it. I was concerned about parking, and I now see the county has been active in helping provide the garage space, which is very needed. So I now can understand why your department proposed this loan and how it fits in with the private money, the entrepreneurs' money, and the county's. But I just wish we had had this to start with. I thank you.
Okay. This is item 13. All in, Governor moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed? Comptroller votes no. Okay. Are there, I'm trying to, Ms.
Thank you.
Ms. Secretary, thank you. And I think what the Treasurer said about the clearly articulated program criteria and goals up front would be very helpful to us. Maybe there's a way to consolidate those other programs. I don't know.
There are a lot of programs.
Okay. We're still on the Secretary's agenda, huh? Okay. Are there others? Mr. Comptroller, do you have other questions on the Secretary's agenda? I would love to call the ones about which there are no questions so that people who might be here on those can go back to work.
Well, I have two more items, so
okay.
Then I'll
which are they?
Refer to you. Items 20.
Okay. Item 20 and item, what's the other one?
Item 20 and item. I want to get rid of the. I want to get rid of the other items, if we can. So item 20 is a matter of controversy, and item
which one? Appendix 7.
Appendix 7.
Appendix 9.
Thank you. Appendix 7 and 9. Is that one item? 7 and 9. Okay. How about anybody? Are there any other matters of controversy on the Secretary's agenda?
Speak on the Secretary's agenda is a wetlands license permit that was brought to you at the July 3rd meeting. You heard Kofi.
And that's item number what?
And that's item 7.
Item 7. Okay. Is there any questions on the balance of the Secretary's agenda item? That is, the rest of the Secretary's agenda, not including items 20, item 7, or appendix 7 and 9, which is part of a public works agenda item. Any questions on those? Any amount of matters in controversy? Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed. And the ayes have it. So anyone that was here on any of those agenda items, you're free to return to work. Did we get anyone? Okay. Give some people some chairs for the second mass. What's that? Okay, hold on 1 second. Hold on. We're just going to let some people clear out so maybe some other people get seats. Do we have many matters in controversy on the budget?
Actually, we might. Yes, that's the legal aid.
Okay, legal aid. What item is that?
Item 7 and 17
on budget. How about any other items on budget?
I don't think you have any other requests. And all the right. Other request
to speak is item 34 on DTS. That's Frederick County. Okay. My guess is, do you think we have a lot of people here on budget?
I think you probably have a lot of people.
Okay.
And the Frederick County item
on DTS. Is that item 44?
But not transportation.
I think transportation, you might be able to flip it out.
I'm just trying to get a sense for why the other folks are here. All right. Well, look, we're going to hold off on the Secretary's agenda item 1 second. Let's go to budget. And we're going to hold aside items 7 and 17, which are the legal aid items in controversy. How about the balance of the Secretary's budget? Anything on the Secretary's budget?
Governor, good morning. There are 21 items. I would like to withdraw item 14 on the DBM agenda.
Item 14 is withdrawn on the DBM agenda.
What is that item?
That's the taxi access program.
The what access program?
The taxi access program.
Okay. I think it needs to be withdrawn. I'll come back later.
All right. Anything else?
So you're going to, there are people signed up on item 7?
7 and 17, you're going to hold right now.
Yeah, we're going to hold that right now. Anything else on the balance of the budget, on the Department of Budget Management agenda? All right, hearing none. Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. So anybody that was here on the balance of those DBM budget things can go. This isn't working too well, is it? No, we got a few. Okay. Got a few.
The other thing is agenda supplement A, the Department of Natural Resources has a lot of people here that just wanted to say thank you for rural legacy grants. You may just be able to recognize them and get a lot of people going on.
Okay, Department of Natural, we're going to hold the balance of the, we're going to hold item 7 and 17, coming back to that one.
We're keeping Marion on our toes on the last one.
Marion, keeping you hopping there.
I do want to say, if we have a minute, that back in the Treasury Building, the Assembly Room, as soon as our meeting is over, we're having a party for Marion. And you can go now, because there's things over there now. Wait for us, but as soon as Marion and I get back, we'll start the party in the Assembly Room.
Catered by the Green Turtle.
And everybody's invited. Please come.
For those of you that read the transcript, that was a joke. Maybe I should do a motion to strike this. It's not really catered by the Green Turtle. It's the same. Okay. Department of Natural Resources, real property agenda items.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Emily Wilson with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 17 items on our agenda today. If you'll bear with me briefly, too, I believe merit extra highlighting this morning. Item 10A is the FY14 allocation of $13.5 million for the state's Rural Legacy Program. We are very grateful for that funding. And this will allow for funding of 15 rural legacy grants in rural legacy areas across the state. Others that are also grateful for that funding are here, and that includes about 11 or 12, I think, of our local rural legacy area sponsors from across the state. Those are both local governments and some land trusts. And they're here today to just provide support and to give thanks.
Anybody want to be heard on this one, if you've come all this way to speak on rural legacy or any of these, are you just happy we're passing over you? Ned Halley, great defender of open space.
Just want to thank the governor for all the work he did to keep the money in the budget. I know it was a big fight. Believe me, it was worth it, and we really appreciate it.
Are there any up in your neck of the woods in this?
There are a few in my neck of the woods. Yes, there are.
Good. Well, that's a model up there through your valley.
We appreciate all the support.
Mr. Halley, good seeing you again. You look younger than ever.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any other questions on the real property agenda items and the Department of Natural Resources, Rural Legacy? This is a terrific program. For any of you listening at home, I encourage you to go on to Maryland Green Print. And we are the only state in these states that has identified and given an ecological ranking to every parcel of land in our state so that we can preserve our necessary green buffers that are required for this Chesapeake Bay region to survive and for the health of our waters and our streams and the like. Related to that is the ag print, and related to both of those are these rural legacy dollars, which oftentimes overlap the two and allow us to preserve terrific corridors. I know that former County Executive Jim Smith, who is now our Secretary of Transportation, was so very proud of the land preservation in Baltimore County, and which has become a model, really. What is that valley called, Jim?
You've got Green Spring Valley. You've got help me out here, Ned.
Worthington Valley.
Worthington Valley.
My Lady's Manor.
Worthington Valley, Green Spring Valley, My Lady's Manor, that whole corridor up there is just... Pull that mic over there with you.
Plus, the local government has also invested a lot and has on their part preserved about 60,000 acres.
And at planning, when people go for degrees in planning all across the country, one of their examples that they study is how Baltimore County, the state of Maryland, the good people up in that part of our beautiful part of our state have managed to come together to bring forward this new land ethic. It's very cool.
It's recognized nationally.
Aldo Leopold would be proud. All right. Thanks. The Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by... You have one more?
Well, we do.
Why are you making faces?
If you wouldn't mind, please. I think we would like to maybe get a picture with the sponsors that are here that came up today.
Sure.
To support. And then there's another item that I would like to highlight, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. What is the other item?
The other item is 14A.
It's 14A?
It's known as the Lake Easement. This is one of DNR's first coastal resilience easements, in that there are climate change adaptation measures that are incorporated into the easement to account for predicted sea level rise in this area. This is also of historic significance as it was part of the Broadus Plantation in Dorchester County where Harriet Tubman was once enslaved. It's along the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Historical Park and Scenic Byway. We worked in conjunction with the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy on this easement, as well as descendants and members of the Lake family, whose descendants were also slaves on this Broadus plantation around Harriet Tubman's time. And we are pleased that we have both Eastern Shore Land Conservancy members as well as representatives and members of the Lake family here today. They're sitting in the back there.
Would anyone like to be heard from the Lake family? Anyone? Okay. Come on down. Come on up to the microphone. Does that Savage River property actually border the Savage River anywhere? Or is it the headwaters? Or where is that? We'll come back to that. Yes, ma'am, and tell us who you are.
My name is Bronte Lake, and I'm a fourth generation Lake. My great-grandfather actually owned the farm. My great-great-grandfather purchased the farm after he became a free slave, and we moved back to the Bucktown area where Harriet Tubman was born. This is my father, Benito Lake. And so it's certainly an honor to be here and to have the easement hopefully approved. We are indeed just a few of... my father is a grandson. There is a sibling, actually a great aunt. It's his aunt that wasn't able to make it here today. She's 92 years old. But she is honored as well to reserve and preserve part of the natural history on the eastern shore.
That's great. What is that body of water there?
Should be also the Transquaken.
Gotcha.
In the Nanticoke.
In the Nanticoke?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, thank you both for coming all the way here, and thank you for preserving this piece of important Maryland history. Mr. Lake, anything you want to say?
Not really.
would you like to join the Board of Public Works? Okay, that's a good one. All right, we're going to have a picture up, Madam Treasurer.
Before we do, could we hear like 2.5 minutes, maybe, of how this fits into Ms. Johnson, how this fits into Maryland's effort to imbue in all of its programs, but particularly these important preservation and infrastructure programs, what we're learning about climate change and mitigation.
Yeah. Sea level adaptation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer. For the record, my name is Zoe Johnson. I work at the Department of Natural Resources, and I oversee our climate change policy. Under the governor's great leadership and Madam Treasurer's leadership, we are working to integrate consideration of climate adaptation principles into all of our land resource, land investments, resource management, as well as our assets. The executive order that the governor signed at the end of December requires us to begin to look at climate adaptation principles in how we design and site our infrastructure investments. So, but beginning with the land investment piece, about 3 years ago, we began to incorporate consideration of sea level rise into the lands that we analyze for purchase or through our easement programs. So the Green Print program now incorporates what we call our wetland adaptation areas. Those are areas where we've mapped that wetlands would migrate inland as sea level rise occurs over time. And so that data and that information, the highest ecologically ranked lands, includes lands where we can protect, and we're targeting to acquire lands that can serve these key features that we will need to better adapt to climate change in the future. So the easement, this first climate resilience easement, is the first in its kind. You know, a number of easement programs are beginning to incorporate specific language that relates to climate change, both from a mitigation perspective as well as an adaptation perspective. But what this does, in particular on the lake easement, is it does a number of things. It protects the wetland migration corridors, so the wetlands will be able to migrate inland as sea level rise occurs. And it maintains a buffer around those key wetland adaptation areas. And it allows us to, the other thing is it restricts development in areas that would be vulnerable to sea level rise over the next 50 years. And it increases the impervious surface limitations on the site to reduce environmental damage due to higher intensity rainfall events. So it better protects water quality as climate change occurs. So it's just a matter of this is one particular easement, but we are working to incorporate language and considerations of a number of climate change adaptation issues into all of our investments at the state level here in Maryland.
Thank you. This is really a landmark move here. I really appreciate it. This is one of the another unsung hero.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is your name again?
My name is Zoe Johnson.
And your position?
I work at the Department of Natural Resources. I'm the program manager for climate policy.
If you see a project called the Four Seasons on our agenda, would you please come back and just...
I understand the Four Seasons was before you last had session. That's another area, obviously, we need to spend some more time thinking about how to incorporate sea level rise issues into our regulatory programs. But we're trying to, from a broad umbrella with respect to climate adaptation, incorporate issues within all our programs and all the activities we do within the state. So thank you for your leadership on this issue, Governor and Treasurer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any public access to the Nanticoke down there? Curious. Yes? Through the woods? That's the public access? I'm inclined to go check that out sometime. All right. Any other questions on open space DNR? Controller moves approval. Treasurer, we're going to do a picture. We're going to approve this, and then we're going to get a picture. So if you're here for the picture, don't go away. Come on up right after. So we moved by the treasurer, seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. And the ayes have it. Any noes? None. It was unanimous. So could anyone who's here for the pictures for the Rural Legacy, the Open Space, any of those agenda items, come on down. And thank you for being part of this program. Or come on up. What am I going there for?
How you doing? Governor, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Governor Council.
Good to see you. What's your name?
John Southcastle.
How you doing, Governor? Good to see you, Matt.
Hey, good to see you.
How's it going, good people? Everybody squeeze together. It'll feel unnatural. It'll look good. Come on. Everybody, if we do kind of side to side, I think we need to do two, Tom?
It's either way. You know, I can do a wide angle just to get more people on that side.
We need some more people around the other side.
Yes.
Good. How about you?
Why don't you go over on that side?
It just keeps flying really
fine.
All right, here we go. We're going to do a wide angle, folks.
Okay, is everybody ready?
Let's just play. I'm
trying to get the spot where you can see me clearly.
All right, everybody smile. Look like you're happy to be here.
All right. Okay, everybody ready? You play? Pop going? Okay, right this way.
Are you really getting everybody?
I'm getting everybody. All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amazing lens.
Thank you all. Thank you. Nice to see you. We're going to do a separate thing with some of you. Thank you all. Thanks a lot. See you. Thanks for your patience. Sorry, I wish I called this earlier. Thank you. See you. Thank you. Thanks for being part of this program. So, come on up.
Good. Come on. Why don't you stand right here?
You're part of this.
Sure.
Yes, you are. Be in the picture. Why not? You're a co-host.
All right. Everybody just kind of group right. Move right in there.
Group together.
Okay.
This is the legacy.
Good, man. Yeah, just stand right over there. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Right this way, please. One more. And one more time. Great, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have anything on the transportation agenda of note? Not aware of any. Nobody signed up on it. Okay. We're on transportation agenda items. Secretary Smith, any thoughts?
Just good morning, and we have 22 items on our agenda. Okay. This is Jim Smith, MDOT Secretary.
And everybody was applauding the building of the Dover Bridge.
Yes, they were.
Rebuilding of the Dover Bridge.
That certainly got a lot of very positive reaction.
That's good. Bipartisan. All right. Controller moves approval. I'm sorry?
And the 301 overpass. Yes.
And the 301, yeah, 304 overpass.
Wonderful.
This is a great job.
On the governor's land.
It got better after the last session. All right. The Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. How about the Department of Information Technology? Mr. Schlanger, you have anything of controversy?
Of course not.
Okay. Well, we'll let the Comptroller be the judge of that.
Good morning, Governor.
Comptroller, any questions?
Mr. Comptroller, LA Schlanger, Department of IT. 5 items on the agenda this morning. Happy to answer any questions.
Madam Treasurer, concerns?
And not a question, but a concern. I understand this is the Secretary's last meeting, the Secretary do it. Is that right?
That would be true. But I'm not leaving to go very far.
Is that why you're smiling so much? And you're going to be a cyber security guru?
I am going to take on the fight of helping Maryland be cyber safe. So I'm not going very far. And I enjoy the new role.
Well, Elliot, thank you. Mr. Schlanger is the very first IT, Secretary of IT that our state's ever had. And you've done an outstanding job, and thank you for being willing to stand up and step up to the big cybersecurity needs that we have and for grooming such a good successor in your job as well. So, Treasurer moves approval. Not only these agenda items, but on the job you've done. Seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Well, how about the University System of Maryland? Any questions, University System of Maryland?
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Jim Sterling for the University System. We have 9 items on today's agenda. I'd be happy to address any questions you have.
Any questions? Comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And how about we go to DGS with the exception of item number 44. Anyone have any questions on the Department of General Services agenda items with the exception of item 44? Nope. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And now we return to matters in controversy. How about we had kind of a due process issue on that wetlands permit. What item was that? Secretary's agenda, item number 7.
Ready to take up. The board listened to testimony on July 3rd.
Would you please okay. Come on up and update us? I know that the concern that we had as on this agenda item was that perhaps affected neighbors were not sent notice of the hearing and given an opportunity to be heard once again here. And we agreed, as I recall at that time, to defer this, to mail out notices, and to give anybody that hadn't been heard an opportunity to be heard that had not already been heard. So can you update us? Where are we? What did you do?
Okay. Good morning, Governor, Comptroller, Treasurer. For the record, I'm Dolan Moore, Wetlands Administrator. And again, before you today is Queen Anne's Landing Marina, case number 11-WL-0208. And again, yes, the board did defer on July 3rd and requested that I do a wider distribution of Maryland Departments of the Environment's report and recommendation. Again, this was due to the two different public information notification process that are set out, one in the law for the Department of the Environment and the other in regulations for the Boards of Public Works. On July 15th, we mailed out 452 packets by U.S. mail. The mailing was comprised from a number of different sources. The 349 Queens Landing Community Units condominium list that was provided by the applicant, MDE's interest file database from its public process, a petition which was received from MDE and I was provided a copy of during its March 15, 2011 public hearing notice, a hearing roster from my April 7, 2011 public hearing, and interested persons that contacted my office directly. A petition was submitted to my office during the first two reviews of the MDE's report and recommendation was also included. And again, any people who signed up to speak on July 3rd, 2013 board meeting. And we also included all state county elected officials that represent Queen Anne's County. The comment period ended July 30th for that supplemental public review, which was the third one. I received during that 15-day period 8 comments. 4 were for and 4 were against. And I did not learn anything different than what I had known before. Okay. And again, I support, you know, my prior recommendation that the board issue the wetlands license for this minimal scope of work, okay, which includes the elements are 2 pier extensions, 3 new finger piers, 1 support pile, and 8 mooring piles.
Gotcha. Madam Treasurer?
Governor, I, again, was the culprit. I was concerned because my understanding was, and we did see that Secretary Summers had made one statement about public dissemination of information and the board had done another. I hope that we can get those coordinated in the future so it doesn't happen again. I appreciate the fact that you did it. We also got copies of the responses, and ours, too, were 50% for, 50% against. But I appreciate very much the fact that the process, that the problem was brought to our attention and the process was created.
And I can't say the department and I, we have started taking steps to coordinate and make sure that, you know, I receive copies of their interested persons list and so forth so that my distribution can be wider than what's required by my regulations.
Thank you.
So did anyone show up here today that hadn't already been heard? Yes, ma'am. Come on up. I recognize you very well. Tell me your name again.
Yes. Good morning.
Hi.
Governor, Controller, Madam Treasurer. It's Susie Elasic, and I live.
We heard from you last time.
Yes, you did.
At great length, 3 times, I think,
thank
in the course
you.
Of that hearing.
Yes.
So
yes.
We're hearing from you one more time.
Yeah, this will be brief.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you very much for seeing that all the homeowners received it. That was very important. We have one little question today, if we may. After the comment period closed on July 30th, Mr. Moore sent us, I suppose everybody, a comment that condition L had been changed in the MDE report. Now, when MDE puts out its report, it has certain conditions the marina has to abide by. And the old condition L in the May report was absolutely perfect because it said no outside boats could be in the marina. Now, no one had a chance to comment after the new condition L came out, and we're very concerned about one word in there. We could just briefly go over it. And I put these together for each of you with the statute, so they're all on one sheet. But basically, the May report and recommendation agreed 100%. And it concurred with the Queen Anne County Code that says a community pier is for the benefit of the residents. It agreed with the Maryland Annotated Code that says one of the requirements of a community marina is that a community owned and established operator for the benefit of the residents in a platted subdivision. Now, the new change, which you have there, says this. It says that, I need my copy back to read it, but basically it says that they changed the whole thing completely and only quoted part of the definition of what family means. They didn't put the word resident in there. And all of the statutes say that it should say resident. The new condition else, if it's not correct, says SWIP ownership or leasing in this community shall be in accordance with the Queen Anne County Critical Area Program and the policies and administrator's decisions adopted by Queen Anne County Planning and Zoning. SWIP owners or lessees may include Queens Landing Condominium residential unit owners or tenants or family members of the Queens Landing Condominium resident unit owners or tenants. So two things are wrong in the new condition. One is it doesn't state that if you're a family member, you should be a resident of the community and conform with the statutes. The second thing here, it says the tenants and family can purchase SWIPs. And this is not according to the declaration. Only unit owners can purchase SWIPs in the marina. So where this got messed up is when the county attorney approved the 2009 marina declaration, it said outside boats could be in the marina. Now, that's still what's recorded in the land records. The marina folks have not changed that. So I guess MDE saw that when they approved everything, but actually it's against the statutes if you allow outside boats in the marina. And then he went on to say, after he received a little bit of static from the marina folks, that, hey, it said outside marina, you approved outside boats, you approved it. Then he came back and said, okay, I'll make an administrative decision and say family can be in the marina. The problem is he didn't use the whole definition of family. Mr. Drummond went on to say that family is defined in Title 18 as one or more persons related by blood, marriage, adoption, or guardianship. He left out the rest of the definition. And the rest of the definition says very simply here that one or more persons so related occupying a dwelling unit and living as a single housekeeping unit. So he accidentally left off the rest of that. But the problem is it left the door open for outside boats in our community marina that I guess makes it a commercial marina, but over the years there have been outside boats. And just on July 3rd, DNR confirmed 6 boats in that marina that do not have Queens Landing addresses. One is even the brother of the owner of all the slips in the marina, Mr. Turlington, who lives in Baltimore, who does not live in Queens Landing. And the problem comes in is not only is it against the statutes, but they use our facilities, our pool, our landscaping, our parking, our trash. So basically, an MDE says in their report on page 2, paragraph 4, the marina has no unresolved zoning issues or violations with Queen Anne County, which is not true because we turned in, QLHT-HFT turned in to the county a report of these 6 votes, which they had at their commissioner's meeting, and we received a letter from the county administrator, Mr. Greg Todd, on the 15th that said, you know, we're having our attorneys look into this. So we don't know whether they're going to issue citations against those 4 votes or what they will do. But there is an issue, of course, now with the county. So here's what we're looking for you to do today. We all want this to get approved and go to bed. As the governor said, this is really the mother of all wetlands licenses, and I'm sure we're all tired of hearing about it. But prior to approving it today, would you please use the statutes for the purpose for which they were written? All the state and county statutes clearly say that anyone who leases a slip in a community marina, be it owner, tenant, or family, must be a resident. The word resident is what's really important here. So here are some options, maybe if you can think about, please. One, require MDE to go back to that special condition L, which was in the May report that we all approved. Or two, if they want to use the new definition of family in their new condition L, which was just changed last week, put in the word resident, or use the whole definition of the code of what family is, that they must be a resident. And also MDE needs to correct the error in condition L that tenants and family can own slips. So thank you again. Oh, the other thing is the marina still has a recorded declaration that says outside boats. Now they changed it on the website to say family, but they didn't use the whole definition. But it's not concurrent and should be filed in the land records properly and not be violating the statutes where it says outside boats. Thank you again for your patience and time. We're not opposed to the approval of the wetlands permit. Our community is just looking to you, the board, to see that the MDE report of recommendation is compliant with the state and county statutes, and thus the marina comply with the fact that family must be a resident per the statutes. And then we can all move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Moore, why did you change the definition from May 8, 2013 to a new definition on August 9, 2013? Ma'am, you can have a seat now. Very eloquent and concise. Thank you very much.
We had, I'd spoken with the Department of the Environment that the language that was used was very, it was unclear and confusing. And who I'd like to have come up with, Emily, the Attorney General's office, to explain a little better that there's some confusion here.
Michonne?
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon almost. My name's Emily Vigneri. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Maryland Department of the Environment. I agree that the first condition in the original May report and recommendation was confusing. It was talking about transient boaters, and it wasn't clear. So the reason that we recommended the revision that we did in our second letter was simply to be consistent with county law. And that's really all the condition is saying, is that the use of the slips, which has clearly been controversial given the history of this marina and the transactions that occurred throughout the history of the development of the condominium, given all of that, it's important to include a condition in here that talks about the use of the marina and acknowledges the fact that it is a community marina. So all that the condition says is the use of the marina should be guided and directed and be consistent with Queen Anne's County Critical Area Program laws.
So what would it hurt to put in the language that everybody already approved in addition to that, saying the use of this community arena or marina by transient boaters or rental of boat slips to boaters other than residents of the community is prohibited?
The problem there is that transient boaters are people who can, a transient boater isn't necessarily someone who owns a slip or rents a slip. It can be someone who, you know, might be visiting their friend in the development for an afternoon or something like that. That person who's just visiting, who's a transient boater, there's no requirement in county law or state law or critical area program law that type of boater or visitor needs to be a resident of Queen's Landing Marina, a family member of Queen's Landing Marina, or anything like that. So that was my issue with the original condition.
Do you believe that the language that you have there prohibits the rental of boat slips to boaters other than residents of the community?
The revision of the slip, does
right.
it prohibit...
The one you did after the public process that people had read?
Does it prohibit the rental of slips to someone other than...
Residents
or family members of residents? I think that the rental can also be to a family member.
I thought the question was family members who live in Boston, for instance.
Uh-huh.
The definition of family members...
I mean, the definition...
Why isn't it constrained?
The definition of family is what I would go to Chris Drummond's letter in his decision on this issue, and that was tied, I think it was Chapter 18. And Chris Drummond looked into the issue, it started as a zoning violation. So he looked at it, did the investigation, the planning and zoning folks did the investigation, determined that there was no issue here, and decided that the interpretation could include residents or family members of residents under Chapter 18. And that was an unchallenged decision. It was an administrative decision. He gave 30 days to challenge it, and no one did.
Questions, concerns, Treasurer Kopp, and recommendations?
I'm still confused. The Queen Anne's County Code limits it to residents.
The Queen
right? And then the question is the definition of residents, how broad that is.
I mean, the Queen Anne's County Code, if you start with the definition of community pier in the Queen Anne's County Code, it says a boat docking facility used by owners and tenants or guests of owners or tenants of condominiums. I mean, it leaves it very broad. So it can be tenants, owners, guests. for what the definition of a community pier is. And then the county lawyer made an interpretation of county law and the requirements and criteria of community pier for the county's requirements. And the recommendation of the Department for Conditional is just to be consistent with how the county is going to interpret its own laws.
I'm sorry, I'm still confused between what you say, what we said last time, and what this piece of paper says.
What? And we said that? What? The original?
The way we first saw it. Yeah.
When you first saw it, it said special conditions.
Do you have a copy of this that you can give to the attorney who's been questioned about?
It's our copy.
So you're asking about the first bullet?
Yeah, I mean, what it looks like is that somebody, I mean, the allegation is clearly that the language was changed after the public process in order to allow people who don't live there to be able to rent boat slips.
Right.
And it would seem that your definition opens the door to that, whereas the prior one did not. And so the question is,
I mean, I guess from the definition in the Queen Anne's County Code has been the same all along. It says that a community pier shall be for the benefit of the residents. That doesn't say, I mean, it's incredibly broad. It doesn't say that what benefit of the residents actually means. It doesn't say that that person has to live there or family, you know, it doesn't specify for the benefit of the residents is all it says. So the way that the Queen Anne's County lawyer then interpreted that through his decision was that for the benefit of the residents, for this community marina, can be a resident of the condominium or a family member of a resident of the condominium.
And then there's the definition of
it. Regardless of whether or not they live there.
Right.
Yes.
Well, now why do you go through the ruse of saying single housekeeping unit as if they have to live there, if they don't have to live there?
That's on
occupying a dwelling unit and living as a single housekeeping unit.
That's from the Queen Anne County Code. I mean, that's not what's in the special condition.
That's not what's in the special condition?
No, the part, are you looking on here where it says incorrect? With the red?
This. Right, correct.
Okay, that is from, that's not on the condition.
Read to me the condition. What book number are we on here, by the way? Thank you. So where is the condition here? Ah, Jesus. Excuse me. What page is it on? I've got a whole raft of stuff here. On
the condition that MDE recommends, if you look, MDE's August 6, 2013 letter.
August 6, 2013. I'm sorry, I've got 100 pages here.
Right,
stuff.
I know. I left my box at home on this file.
Gotcha. The one that has the date right down there at the bottom.
Okay. This is the revised recommendation.
Okay, the revised recommendation, special condition L, is as follows. This is great. This is like, so I didn't attend class in law school. Slip ownership or leasing in this community marina shall be in accordance with the Queen Anne's County Critical Area Program and the Policies Administration decision adopted by Queen Anne's County Planning showing the price. Slip owners' leases may include Queen's Landing condominium residential unit owners or tenants or family members of Queen's Landing unit owners or tenants. And that was changed from your prior one that said the use of this community marina by transient boaters or rental slips of boaters other than residents of the community is prohibited.
Right.
So the first one, you were caused you concern. So I'm not a lawyer. The first one caused you concern because of the initial phrase, the use of the marina by
transient boaters, right.
Because that might interfere with residents, guests. That's what you said.
Right.
So in order to take care of, but the ownership is limited to residents of the community. So in order to take care of that, we have changed it to say that families of residents may own it and be silent on the use. Is that right?
I mean, yes, because
the use is silent. It can be used by anyone now.
Right.
Whether they're transient or non-transient. So it doesn't take care of your problem. No one's prohibited from using it. But the ownership has been expanded from residents to families of residents.
The ownership is consistent with Chris Drummond, the Queen Anne County attorney's interpretation of community marina requirements and who may own slips at Queens Landing Marina.
But the state law says that a community marina is for the benefit, whatever that is.
Right. It says it's community owned and established and operated for the benefit of the residents. That's all that it says, which to me is very broad.
It doesn't say anything about families.
Right. But for the benefit of residents, it could
be. For the benefit of the residents. It doesn't say anything. You're right.
Exactly.
As long as it's.
Right.
So we're giving this whatever it is that brings us before us. And I thought everybody thought this was to be a community marina to be used by the residents.
And
leased by the residents. The
owned steps. And leased by residents or family members of residents. Which is what Chris, that is not before us. From the department's perspective, that, as far as we understand, has been the way it's been since at least Chris Drummond's letter in 2011. And that was part.
What was before us? What was submitted to us?
In MDE's report and recommendation on May 3rd. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
You're right. We had a different condition, but that condition was not accurate or correct
at
the time.
It would have been accurate if we voted then. It would have been what we did. I'm sorry. I'm not an attorney. I'm just a confused layman.
Well, it sounds like you did a bit of a bait and a switch here. No. Yes, sister. Sir, do you want to be heard?
Yes.
Yeah, come on up, by all means. We love wetlands permits.
Good to see you all again.
It's great to see you.
Thank you. I think with what's going on here, as far as statutes are concerned and definitions of statutes, and it very clearly states in the interpretation statute of 14.16 of the Critical Area Commission Code of Queen Anne County. And I'll read it for you. Determine the actual impact of various proposed interpretations permitting flexibility in design but prohibiting an interpretation that lowers the protect afforded to the public and would be inconsistent with the goals and objectives of the program and the requirements of Chapter 8, 1801 of the DNR Annotated Code of Maryland. So what that says is that the most restrictive statute takes precedent. So whatever Chris Drummond writes, or whatever DNR interprets, MDE interprets, it's the most restrictive statute that must be imposed. The most restrictive statute says that you must be a resident and a unit owner in the community in order to have a slip in that community. You must be a unit owner or a resident or a tenant being a resident, in order to lease a slip in that community. And one more thing, as far as the I'll repeat what the definition of family is right here. It says one or more persons related by blood, marriage, adoption, or guardianship, or not more than five persons not so related, occupying a dwelling unit and living as a single family housing unit. If you're a family member, you must reside in that unit in the community.
And
that's Queen Anne County Code 18.1.
And is that the definition of family members in this paragraph we're reading with the new? It's not defined.
It's defined in the Queen Anne County Code. It's the one I read from you to you right here. It's 18.1 definition of family code.
Right. So is that what's incorporated in this? Is that the family? Is that the definition that this? Then there's no issue.
The problem with the special condition L is that it's inappropriate. It doesn't comply with any of the statutes. That's the problem. You know, it sets a dangerous precedent for every community marina in the state of Maryland. You know, the legislation comes up with these laws, and it's, I guess, the governing bodies to make sure they're implemented.
Why don't we just add the words living in said owner's unit? How about that?
That would be, Governor, that's excellent. That's exactly what we said earlier on.
Okay. Are you okay with that? Are we okay with that? Madam Treasurer?
Yep.
Okay. You okay with that?
Okay, sir.
Yeah, we're going to add the words living in said owner's unit.
Perfect.
Just a quick question. I mean, there are owners who own but don't actually live there, right? So that wouldn't, you know, doesn't matter. I mean, we could just take it out.
No problem. Owner lives.
What's that?
That's the owner lives. Owner lives. You be an owner or live in the resident.
The family member has to live there.
There are a number, from my understanding of the community, there are a number of people who own but do not live there. So if you added that language that you just suggested, it would prohibit people who own but live somewhere else from owning a slip or renting a slip at the condo. I would just say that this condition consistent, the way that MDE wrote it to be consistent, and it's my opinion that it is consistent with Queen Anne's County Critical Area Program law,
mm-hmm.
as the county interprets its own critical area program mm-hmm. requirements.
Governor, if I may.
Yes,
Gary
sure.
Setzer, I'm the administrator of the Wetlands and Waterways Program. Condition L was originally proposed to try to address the concerns of the community about the use of the marina. It was meant to be consistent with the state critical area statute and the county's critical area program and their regulations. The LASIX and some of the other commenters in the last go-around brought up concerns about its consistency with both state law, county code, state regulations. So the changes that we're offering to Condition L were meant to address the inconsistencies that were brought to our attention. As it's written, it's consistent with the state critical area law, and in fact, Ms. Benary and I were at the critical area offices when we wrote that condition. It's consistent with the critical area law. It's consistent with county ordinance. It's consistent with the administrative record that the county attorney offered in its letter of March 9, 2011. And to change Condition L haphazardly could end up with unintended consequences. My recommendation would be either keep it as it is or drop it. It was only there to support the county's regulation of the marina. Thank you.
But if you drop it, then it's open to as many people as...
Well, then it's open to the county whose program and whose ordinance it is.
But, you know, so the cleaner way to do this with only one word would be to insert the word resident in front of family members of Queen Anne's.
Exactly. Right?
If you're going to, if you're going to add resident in front of family members, then there's no reason to even have it. It basically says you have to live there to own a rent.
All right. I think that's their point. And that was what was in the original L.
That is the Lasik's point. That's correct.
Right.
But it's not consistent with county ordinance or the county attorney's 2011 letter.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were going for was consistency with state law, state critical area law, and the state and the county ordinance.
I'm inclined to put in resident. You don't want to put in resident? Okay. Controller moves that we insert in condition L.
There are other people who would like to speak.
Ah, goody. How about, look, I'm just trying to send you all to court, because that's where you're going anyway, okay? And this is, you want to be heard? I don't want to cut off due process. Lord knows we've been rolling in it on this one for months and months and months. Please, by all means, come up, sir, and identify yourself for us.
Good morning, Governor. At least I think it's still morning.
It's afternoon now.
Governor O'Malley, Treasurer, Comptroller, my wife and I are full-time Queens Landing residents. And I am now, about a year ago, I became the treasurer of the horrible boat slip unit at Queens Landing. In December 2009, in order to prevent the marina from becoming a commercial marina, the former owner deeded the boat slip unit, which is the equivalent of the condo that I live in. It's treated the same. That consists of the docks, the piers, the pilings, the bulkhead, and the walking path. That was deeded to an entity named Queens Landing Community Marina LLC, which is who's really before you today on this application. Because Queens Landing did not have $1.5 million to buy the slips, the seller retained the right to sell 69 of the 62 approved boat slips. Again, approved boat slips, but only to owners of condominiums in Queens Landing. And I'm using that term loosely and not getting in this legal argument that is going back and forth here that, quite frankly, I find a little absurd. But only to owners of condominiums in Queens Landing. The 62nd slip was donated to the Kent Island Volunteer Fire Department to dock their fireboat. The boat slip owners absorbed the cost of the fire department's share of the operating costs of the marina. The former owner of the marina was in the business to make a profit, and reinvestment in the marina docks and walking path was minimal. During the approximately 3 years and 7 months of its existence, the boat slip owners have spent over $40,000 on maintenance and improvements, paid over $27,000 in dues to the condo community, spent over $30,000 on insurance to protect the members of the Council of Unit Owners from any marina liability, and paid all of the other costs of operating and maintaining the marina. In addition, the boat slip owners have accumulated over $60,000 in reserves to protect the community from future repairs expenses. The boat slip owners have also arranged with the Natural Resources Maryland Grow Oyster Program to host 6 oyster cages in our marina this fall. If that proves to be successful, we will increase the quantity in subsequent seasons. All of this is a major improvement from what the community had before the transaction. As part of the transaction, the Board of Queens Landing required the seller to do the following. And this is what we're here about. Finish the partial sea dock T-head and add one pile under a weak section of that T-head. Relocate slip C-13 so that the bulkhead space that was slip C-13 could be made into community access landing and small boat access by all of the community members, and that has been done. The slip 13 is pulled out.
How about to the point that we're... I'm sorry, I thought you wanted to talk about whether or not you all should... whether it should be restricted to people that actually own units there or not.
Well...
are we getting to that one?
I wanted you to hear that there are real live people that we're talking about.
Oh,
here.
Yes, sir. I know. I've met many, many, many of them over the course of this. Why don't you continue? You seem intent on reading this to us, so you go ahead. How many more pages is it? And I feel I'm very badly for all of you who came here early to have your matters heard, and now we're at 12:30. I feel badly. I wish there were a better way to manage this. Sometimes when the docket comes up, there's more controversy and more contest. So thank you for bearing with us. Sir, you go ahead.
Governor, I've been standing against the back wall since well before 8:30.
Well, so I'm so sorry to interrupt you. You go ahead.
All right. So we, C-13 has been removed.
C-13. Tell us which one C-13 is.
It's on the bulkhead in the corner. I'd be happy to show you if you have a diagram.
I've got it right here. Which one's C-13? Let's see which one C-13 is. Great. You go ahead. Keep telling us about C-13.
So we have created benefit there for the community. In addition to all the financial investments the boat slip owners have made, the other requests are to, and I won't. You've obviously had enough hearing from me. I'll skip a little bit.
Well, I just thought you were going to speak to the issue in controversy, which is whether or not we should put the word resident in there or not. And maybe you could help enlighten us.
All right. Well, I'll tell you.
I don't see what C-13 has
to do
with that issue.
I'll give you an example of what we need to be careful doesn't happen on that issue. In April of 2004, my wife and I purchased an interest in Queens Landing. And we lived in New Jersey. We were full-time residents in New Jersey. We docked our boat in Queens Landing Marina. And in July of 2011, my wife and I retired and moved in. And so now we are owners and residents. We have about a third of our community where the unit they own in the community, they are not primary residents in. They have... a lot of them live in the general Baltimore, D.C. Metropolitan area. I ask you, please, to be careful that you don't create wording so that the people can take...
It wouldn't say that. It says owners already.
Well, I want to make sure, because they keep stressing residents. They want it to be an owner, at least the way I interpret it. They might want it to be an owner and a resident.
No, the conjunct, it's a disjunctive.
Or. We agree with you.
Okay. If you would make careful that we don't end up in court on that issue later, I would appreciate that. All right. I'll withdraw the rest of my comments.
Okay. Thank you. So the treasurer moves the insertion of the word resident between or and family on condition L. Seconded by the comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Now we're on this item, 7, for final consideration. Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We now move on. Thank you all very, very much for your patience. We move on now to item number... secretary's agenda, item number 20.
Dr. Lieberman is here. Are you prepared to answer any questions?
Morning, Governor.
Good morning, Mr. Lieber.
Madam Treasurer, the Comptroller. Glad to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor. This item is adding $18.1 million in new air conditioning projects in several public schools across the state. Obviously, my interest in this issue is well documented. I do want to thank Governor O'Malley and the legislative leadership and the treasurer and others for their commitment to providing our children, educators, and volunteers
with air conditioning dollars so they can have a safe, comfortable learning environment. My understanding of this program is the legislature appropriated $25 million specifically for air conditioning projects such as this. We approved $400,000 back in the spring. We're going to approve $18.1 million today. That's a total of $18.5 million. Dr. Lever, where is the list of proposals for the remaining $6.5 million? What jurisdictions do you think that money will be invested?
There were no applications for that money, so we will have that money revert to the statewide contingency account to be applied in the FY15 CIP, the upcoming CIP, with a preference given to air conditioning projects. But we don't know what air conditioning projects we might receive.
Okay. Then, since you're a tremendous leader in this area, my question is, I understand 86 of the 172 schools in Baltimore City lack air conditioning. At least they did several a year and a half ago, according to the latest memorandum from you. Given that we've gone through two public school construction program funding cycles, what is the current number and percentage of schools in Baltimore City that still lack air conditioning? I think that was a 2011 memorandum, so we're talking 2 years. How many schools in Baltimore City lack air conditioning?
I don't have those figures with me now. We can get that information for you.
Okay. It does surprise me a little bit that there's only one application from Baltimore City. If there were 86 schools that lack air conditioning.
There were two applications. One of them was not eligible.
Okay. Then the Prince George's applications I see are 8 public schools for a total of $2.5 million. That amounts to about $300,000 per school. Baltimore County is $11.7 million. For 5 schools, that's an average of $2.3 million. What is the explanation of the disparity, $300,000 versus $2.3 million?
The Baltimore County projects are for the entire facility, and these are for elementary schools. 5 of the requests are elementary schools. Total cost for an elementary school air conditioning is about $5 to $6 million. One of them is a middle school. Total cost for middle school is about $7 or $8 million. Prince George's projects are partial air conditioning projects of a school. For instance, the first two, Melwood and Allenwood, the rest of that school is being, of those two schools, are being air conditioned under separate projects that were also approved by the Board of Public Works in FY13 and FY12. Duval High and High Point High, it's only certain wings in the school that are being air conditioned. There are gym air conditionings in Largo High, Potomac High, and Thurgood Marshall Middle School. Those run to about $200,000 total cost. William Schmidt is being entirely air conditioned, but that's a very, very small facility.
Terrific. And I have great respect for you and your remarkable deputy, Ms. Schaefer. I have every confidence in the IAC that you have the appropriate criteria for these projects. I'm happy, obviously, for the students who are not going to have to work or study in a greenhouse, triple-digit heat, in the schools that are on this list. But here's my question. How does the IAC determine who picks the winners and the losers in this selection process? Do you have criteria that, you know, is an objective, fact-based system that basically decides or looks at which of these schools receive air conditioning assistance?
Well, we have our recommending approval of 19 out of the 20 applications. The only one we're not recommending approval of is the one I mentioned in Baltimore City, which is not eligible this year. We have no control over what's submitted to the IAC. The applications come from the local jurisdictions. They make their own determination. As long as there's agreement between the local government and the school board setting the priorities, then we review for eligibility according to very strict criteria.
Okay. Well, but you don't have those objective criteria. You assume that's being done there's some kind of clinical model down at the local level that's doing
it? I think it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There is no one set methodology for determining priorities in the whole universe of capital improvements.
Okay. Well, let me just get to what I see as the problem here. We've got five schools in Baltimore County: Parkville, Featherbed Lane Elementary, Woodlawn, Scotts Branch Elementary, Wellwood International, Hawthorne Elementary. All of them are aging schools. They're situated in economically, socially diverse communities. And obviously the news today for those schools is good. People are happy. The investment's going to be made. It's a shame that they won't be in place by next Monday when school starts. But I'm pleased to see an investment being directed in that way. But here's my question. You've got in Baltimore County Westown Elementary in Catonsville. It was built in 1951, earlier than any of the five schools that are on the list for getting money. It's older than all those schools. Doesn't have any special logistical or architectural impediments. It's located in the largest Title I population of any school that still lacks air conditioning up in Baltimore County. It's a wonderful school. I've been there several times. Got a tight-knit group of parents. Today, for me, inexplicably, they're not on the list. They're not discussed in the background materials. So my complaint is that I think of Denise Zavara and other parents up there, the PTA, their community volunteers that have been advocating this issue for as long as, frankly, I've been comptroller. She has to go home and tell her kids and her PTA members, gee, sorry, some of the schools in Baltimore County were taken care of, but ours, the oldest, without air conditioning, right in the middle of a critical Title I area, our school's not one of them. So I don't know how you tell your kids that. You know, our school just didn't make the list. You know, I guess somehow she screwed up because she moved into that school district. And, you know, it's her kids that are at the school. And my concern, of course, is that we end up with this really unfortunate political game that affects the safety and innocent health of innocent people. And we're picking winners and losers. There's no plausible, credible, or clinical rationale. So I'm just repeating what the county exec said some time ago, which is, you know, I'm giving this money out to people who have representation that voted for the, I think it was the alcohol tax increase then. My concern is there's nothing there that is objective that these parents can hang their hat on. Let me just get your sense while you're here. Why doesn't the IAC support portable box units, cost-effective alternatives to this incredibly glacial progress being made to put central air conditioning in these dozens and dozens of schools?
Okay. Could I just add, there are currently 23 projects in Baltimore County that are in various stages of being air-conditioned. There are 12 projects that were approved in the FY14 CIP, including three major renovations, the five projects under consideration today, and six projects that have no state participation, which are being done through an energy performance contract.
So how many tens of thousands of Baltimore County kids are going to show up next Monday? God forbid that there's a hot day, but what exactly, how many tens of thousands of students in Baltimore County are going to have triple-digit temperatures in their classrooms starting Monday if the climate doesn't cooperate?
We don't have that kind of information. We can ask them how many classrooms will not be air-conditioned and then perhaps extrapolate that to the number of students who would occupy those classrooms.
I would appreciate it if you would send back to the colleagues on the board, but particularly to me, how many tens of thousands of Baltimore County students are going to school August 26th in unair-conditioned classrooms? Not the number of classrooms, not the number of schools, the number of students. If you would, that would make that would be terrific. I'm told by Baltimore County we can't possibly move to box units or any kind of interim air conditioning because that creates a safety problem for the kids. I'll tell you what a safety problem is, 110 degree temperatures in a classroom with very little air circulation.
Your question about why the IEC's position on boxed units, the IEC supports investments that have a 15-year life. That has to do with the life of the bonds. Boxed units have less than a 15-year life. They are temporary installations. They are not energy efficient. They create a building system which can't be balanced. Which means that certain areas become cool, other areas are not air-conditioned. There's some incidental implications like noise and so forth. Some systems have used them. They have certainly installed them. You know, they get the cool, but they also have a problem with the other associated problems. But the determination was made that because they don't have a 15-year life, that they would not be eligible items.
Right, I understand that, and I just refer you back to that wonderful gentleman with the unpronounceable name in Anne Arundel County, Alex S-Z-A-C-H-N-O-W-V-I-C-Z, an extraordinary COO. I just call him Alex. I mean, he did the entire county, you know, average cost $125,000, $250,000 for a larger school. I hear what you're saying about the life of these, but I would really importune you to go back and once you get us the figures on August 26th, how many tens of thousands of students are going to be in unair-conditioned classrooms in Baltimore County, and why don't you, while you're at it, give us the tens of thousands of students on August 26th in Baltimore City that will be sitting in triple-digit temperature if the temperature goes up. And if you could, ask the IAC to reconsider its concern about the 15-year life. Frankly, the ones in Anne Arundel have already been there 11 years. So four more years, and they're working real well. No problems. Nothing untoward. See if the IAC would not consider something on an emergency basis, because these kids are dripping in sweat. They put their heads down. They fall asleep. The teachers faint. It is a public safety issue, and it's not getting done. It is not getting done. And, you know, some of these kids in Cadenceville, my God, they'll be getting senior meal discounts before they get air conditioning at the rate we're going. So let's go back and be creative, because it's very troubling to me that there's so much resistance to solving this problem, and it could be done quite quickly and quite inexpensively.
I'll take that request to the IAC.
Yeah, but I'm really interested in the information about the 40, 50, 60,000 kids that are going to be wringing their jeans and their socks out when they get home because there's so much sweat in them after sitting in these classrooms. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you. Controller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to... Appendix number 7 and 9. That was item 20 we just approved. Okay, we're done with 7.
Right.
Now we're on. Did we do DGS 44 or not?
Okay. Those two are the big ones. I think the Secretary can probably answer the questions.
Okay, Appendix 7 and 9 on the Secretary's agenda.
And I apologize for asking questions on these things, but for the record, I didn't ask anything in Queen Anne's Marina. that's going to be a chapter in someone's book down the road. Queen's Landing, I guess. Mr. Secretary, thank you. Item, is it an appendix item? Is it 9?
7 and 9. 7 is the substance abuse treatment and 9.
Okay, great. Thank you. Item 7 is a $395,000 award to InterDynamics. Apparently, Second Genesis, the incumbent, had performance issues.
Yes, sir.
What were these performance issues?
Very briefly, Mr. Controller, they were issues of MBE compliance, also issues of licensing. And I have with me Ms. Sandy Davis Hart, who is the chief of our substance abuse, and she can speak more clearly to the particular issues.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Sandy Davis Hart. I'm the Chief of Substance Abuse Treatment Services for the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. In terms of the non-compliance issues, the contract with Second Genesis required them to have licensed clinical counselors as part of the COMAR requirements for treatment programming, and in the past year they had performance issues providing those counselors. And in addition to that, there was also a 10% MBE requirement to their contract, and they were having issues paying the MBE subprime.
Okay. So the losing bidder on this contract, which was necessitated by this lack of performance, was Godencia. And apparently you turned them down. I'm delighted that InterDynamics won. They're a Maryland company. That's great. But you turned down the low bidder, Godencia, because you said they have performance issues relating to a separate contract where they provide substance abuse treatment at four other institutions within Maryland.
That's correct.
What's going on there?
Some of the same issues. There have been MBE issues as well, not with them paying the subprimes, but with them meeting the 10% contractual requirement for their contract, as well as finding qualified licensed clinical professionals to provide the services.
Okay. So the MBE, to me, is obviously something we want to hold everyone's feet to the fire, but I don't see it as breaking a contract in emergency action, but this other, to the extent that folks are bidding low on contracts and getting them and then not performing, that definitely catches my eye. And so I'll wait to hear what the status of these other institutions are, I guess.
In addition, I would add that Second Genesis also provided us a letter with intent to cease treatment with less than 30 days' notice.
Yeah, no. It's, well, you see what the problem is. If the low bidders are winning these things and then you're not able to get performance out of them, that obviously is of concern, but it sounds like you're on top of it. If I could ask the Secretary while he's here on item 9, if I could, Governor.
Yes,
this is a $3.9 million system that will prohibit the use of cell phones by inmates of Baltimore City Detention Center. Obviously, that strikes everybody as a good idea.
Sure.
What is the system?
The system that TCOR has is one that captures the radio signals, the radio frequencies that come in, analyzes those signals to see if they are authorized or not authorized. Those that are authorized would be numbers like 911 or official numbers within the facility. If it's an official number, it's allowed to go through. If it's not, it's stopped there, and that number is captured, and we can analyze it later to see where it came from. There are systems that jam signals. This is not a jamming. Mm-hmm. Jamming is only authorized for the federal government and not state agencies. This one is successfully deployed at the Metropolitan Transition Center. It's been in effect for about a year, and it is effectively stopping all the radio transmissions, which are phone signals coming in.
So that is blocking all the signals.
In the Metropolitan Transition Center, where and we started that, that's a prison in Baltimore.
It's different than the BCD.
The old penitentiary.
Okay.
This is for the jail, the 3,000-bed detention center.
The BCDC, the one that's...
Yeah. No, I'm very sensitive. I know everyone's very sensitive about
back
this
up here. Please. Secretary, we started with the Maryland Correctional and Training Center
as the initial sort of test site, correct?
Yes. The old penitentiary, the MTC, they call it downtown.
Mm-hmm. And it was only after their proof of technology, because there's only one other system in the country that's using this technology.
They set a standard. We set a standard in the contract originally with TCOR on the MTC that it deflect or capture 98% or better of the signals. They exceeded that. We awarded the contract to them last year. That one is working well. There are other, California has a system they're trying to put online, a different company. Texas has a system. Mississippi has this system, but it's in a rural area at Parchment. This is the only system that works, operates in a city. This will be the first jail that has managed access, and obviously jails are a problem because people come in, they go out, cell phones are smuggled in.
So the just to keep my things straight here, the earlier one that was tested, is that also are guards and administrators allowed to receive cell phone
official
messages?
Number, yes, official numbers can come through. 911 emergency numbers can come through. Those that are not authorized cannot. They cannot go out,
so
they can't come in.
The appeal of this technology is that you're not blocking everything.
Right.
You're, I guess, allowing certain calls and everything else you're blocking.
Right. And that's a major concern of jamming, because it jams everything. This does not. It's selective about what it jams.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm going to vote for this, but let me just ask you while I've got you here. Apparently a lot of concern that there are employees, managers, and others that are in these prisons that have been compromised as far as their honesty. Where are we in saying everyone who works at this facility needs to have a polygraph test as a benchmark so that we can know who is... I mean, it's a relatively small number, I agree,
right.
But it's if there are a lot of them still, why don't we give everyone a polygraph and make sure that, everyone's honest who's, for example, allowed to have a cell phone and take messages? And where are we in that? Is that a strategy?
We have polygraphed the top administration of the Baltimore City Detention Center, the jail administrator, the security chief, the assistant jail administrator. Security chief did not pass. She has been terminated. She's facing federal charges. The others did pass. We are doing integrity interviews on majors, captains, lieutenants. Polygraphing every 700 employees would be extremely expensive. So we are asking for capability to polygraph new employees that come into the system and also polygraph them as they apply for promotions later on. So
How expensive? 700 people, polygraphs. Trust me, the black guy we've got would be much improved if you found the money, and I'm happy to vote for it, is just put everybody through a polygraph. It's not perfect. Make sure you've got the right criteria. Make sure everyone's included. So it's not just the top management. And then you would at least have some confidence that who's there is on the level.
Right. I'm pretty confident that we are, through the integrity interviews and through some of the phone intercepts that we have made where individuals, inmates, families are calling other correctional staff. We're making some cases on those. If I could just take a moment to run through some of the...
I love that. Other strategies, I'm sure you're...
Some of the things we're doing. We're doing electronic identification of all visitors that come in, so we run a background check when they come in, see if they have a criminal history. If they do, then they have to get permission to visit. In some cases, we do allow it if it's a family member. In most cases, we don't. We've developed a computer system that randomly... it takes a system of 700 employees. It randomly selects 30 of those each day. Those individuals randomly are subject to intensive search. It also selects 30 or more cells and 30 or more detainees and randomly searches those. We're doing the internal investigations unit. We're revamping it. We're making the intel side of internal investigations, putting them in the same unit so that they communicate better together. We also upgraded the camera system throughout the Baltimore City Detention Center and several other facilities that will allow us to look at 45 days recording of activities that take place in the jail. So,
I support all those strategies. I think they're terrific. I would strongly recommend, you're the expert, not me, but boy, it sure makes sense given the publicity that this has gotten. I can't imagine it's more expensive than this T-Corps system. Give all 700 employees a polygraph, and here's why. When our law enforcement folks go to national conventions, there's a lot of talk about Maryland. And, you know, we need to really show, in addition to these strategies, that this is... And I would also recommend it for the hundreds and hundreds of corrections employees who are absolutely honest, because they're all stigmatized now. Who's honest? I mean, you're telling me, you're the expert. If you want to do polygraphs, go for it, because I think that would be an enormous improvement. And, you know, what's the worst that we could find? That there are another 20 or 30 people that don't pass? That would clear everybody else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Controller moves approval of these two agenda items, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Secretary Maynard, thank you for your leadership. All right. We move on now to, what the heck are we? We have two remaining items. It's the Frederick one and the...
Children in need of assistance, legal services, and the other is the capital grant and loan for the Frederick County
nursing homes.
It's 44
in
DGS and
7
and
17
on
DVM. I don't suppose either of these matters is settled.
I think they're both ready.
Return
that. All right. Anybody have any pleasure? Which one of these we want to take first? Yes? No? Maybe? I think the Frederick one seems simpler. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, let's do the Frederick item 44 in DGS. This is a continued item.
This is item 44, CGL, on the DGS agenda. It's a request by the Board of County Commissioners of Frederick County that the DPW Board approve the selling of real property located at 191020 Rosemount Avenue, as well as retaining the sale of the proceeds to pay down the outstanding construction debt. We're prepared to answer any questions.
And when we broke last time, when we deferred this last time, it was for the purpose of what?
So that you can give the attorney for BPW an opportunity to give some feedback on whether or not BPW had the authority to stop the sale.
So where is Greg not here? He's on vacation. Greg's on vacation.
Yes, sir.
You know, you have a memorandum that is, I think, in all of your files, in which she concluded that the board of public works has authority to go ahead and act now on this part of the case, even though the legal cases on other parts of the case are pending, that the board can act on this at this point if the board wants to act on that. He is aware that another lawsuit was filed on Friday, and he said that that did not, as he left on vacation on Monday, that did not alter his advice, that the board has the authority to act now if the board wants to act now. And Deputy Attorney General J.B. Howard reviewed the memorandum and did send us a communication that he agreed with the conclusion of General Counsel Greg Fetter.
That
mm-hmm.
we have the authority to act now.
Yeah.
If we think it's appropriate.
If you think it's appropriate, that's exactly right. That you could act if you want to. These judicial proceedings do not stay the board's authority in any event, but the board can determine when it wants to act.
I have some questions about the contract and our legal authority, and I'm troubled by the fact that neither the Attorney General nor our attorney is here, but what are the criteria on which we would not not prove it?
What is your question, Trevor?
The basis for not approving. I mean, what did it, this is another one of these issues where the Board of Public Works is acting as an Uber County Council or Board of Zoning or whatever. What are the criteria? In some sense, I'm sorely troubled by this whole thing, but I don't know what authority I have to vote. For instance, I'm told that we should forgive this money because Aurora will continue to operate the facility as skilled nursing and assisted living home. But I don't have anything that shows me that that will in fact happen or that that should be of significance to us.
Madam Treasurer, I can for it.
Meaning that that is enough to hang your hat on not approving it. I don't mean right. to say it shouldn't be of significance.
Having served some many years ago as a
attorney,
council,
yes.
And having transitioned into this position, but worked with the bond program and Ms. Enzer for many years on this. My interpretation is that the board's authority to approve or not approve is limited to what your interest is here, is the general obligation bond proceeds as the superintendent of state debt. That is your authority here. And because this is a matter of general obligation bond proceeds that were granted to a nonprofit and a county organization, the board is probably, I mean, it is, yes, it's given great authority to superintend what happens with the proceeds, but in fact, it should probably be limited, just as we saw in the wetlands case, it should probably be limited to what the implications of the state debt is here. And that is $200,000 out of a $10 million project. The state gave $200,000. You just want to protect the taxpayers' investment. And that's where your authority comes from.
It's actually $30 million.
But the original bond bill said, application said $10 million. I have a copy of that.
And we're not looking for forgiveness.
Okay, that, you're going to go ahead and, if you should, for the record, maybe make this the statement about the $200,000.
President of the Board of County Commissioners, refer to County Blaine Young, here to just follow up and be available for any questions, but we're not looking for forgiveness. Matter of fact, I've got a $200,000 check right here that I can hand over today, so I'm not looking for forgiveness.
Okay, so
I brought a check in hand.
Currently, the recommendation in your book from the Department of General Services is to approve the transfer and also to forgive the debt, and Mr. Young is saying that he can we can ask that the second part to be went up.
So if the debt is not forgiven, then the whole paragraph, we forgive it because it's going to continue to provide services, is not of significance, and therefore our doubt about whether services will be continued to be provided is not relevant. Is that?
Actually, I think your is a DGS bonus. I think it's actually 191. We just found out the date, but I'll gladly give you 200. We'll get the 9,000 back at a later time. I trust you.
Everyone's always asking me, when I go out, where's the check? They want me to...
in hand.
How'd you do that?
I told them, told the board I want a live check. It's in hand.
And is David, Commissioner David Gray here?
Yes, he is.
You want to be heard, Commissioner?
And he was, you know, the vote was 4-1. I do want to, you know, point that out. So he is not in favor of any action that we are doing.
All right. So I assume the commissioner was the one. How you doing, Commissioner?
I have here with me three people who are unable to sign on but have experience and comments and haven't spoken before that bear on this issue. Dr. Joe Berman, Leslie Paul, and former County Commissioner Jan Garden, who was president of the board last term and has considerable experience in the Montague issue. If I may, I'll introduce them, but if I may, I have a short five paragraph thing that I can read to you because I think it sums it up nicely. I also corresponded with you after the last hearing. I watched you on the TV version, and so I was aware of the different things you had in your mind. And I forwarded a DVD of the public hearing that we had. I know you don't have a lot of time, but maybe your staff had a chance to look at it. I think that hearing tells you a lot about the process that's happened in Frederick County. But for today, I want to just deliver this set of thoughts to you. It all started with a deed in 1828, which transferred the property on which Citizens Nursing Home and the Montview Assisted Living Facilities now stand from Elias Bruner to Frederick County. This deed stated that the property was to be used for the benefit of the poor of said county and for no other use, intent, or purpose whatsoever. This was entered into the court records and is there to this day. Since then, that land so dedicated has been utilized by Frederick County in accordance with the deed. The date of the sale of the property to an outside for-profit entity will break that pledge that has been kept for more than 180 years. In early June of this summer, the Frederick News Post editorial board interviewed the Citizens Montview Board of Trustees, of which we have three members here today. The Board of Trustees was in opposition to the sale. They had indicated by then that they were prepared to go to court because they believed that the deed binds the county to ownership of those facilities. The opposition of the trustees to the sale was called an impediment by some members of the board to the sale that needed to be eliminated. Even the county attorney admitted that the sale of the facilities was an area of the law that was vague and could lead to a court challenge. Well, the way that those who wanted to sell could get rid of the impediment to the Board of Trustees was to abolish the Board of Trustees. Never mind the trustees had much more management savvy, were much closer to financial and other issues of the facilities, and they had the passion and affection for the patients. The education level and experience of the trustees was and is exceptional. On June 25th, a large public hearing was held. That's the DVD I sent to you to your offices. The largest in this present board's term. Virtually all the testimony was in opposition. There were hundreds of people there. The hearing was also to consider an alternative management proposal by the Board of Trustees. The Commissioner Chairman did not even open time for any testimony regarding the Board of Trustees' proposal. After all had spoken, he summarily called for a vote on the sale and on abolishment of the Board of Trustees. Both motions passed with little comment. I'm asking this Board of Public Works to postpone any further action on this issue until the court challenge to the sale is settled and the dust is on the ground and we know where we are legally. And also, I would hope that this board or the next board during this time would re-examine the public process because I feel it is quite deficient and the public comment and concerns to a large extent were ignored. So. If I may introduce the members that are with me. Oh, yeah, I need to say this. There was no meeting of the county commissioners to cut a check to you.
Pardon?
There was never any meeting. There was never any proposal for the county commissioners to meet on and vote to allow Blaine to hand you a check today. So.
I think part of the overall vote that we took for one minute, but I just said county attorney's here to verify. I don't think that
was clear in the minutes.
Okay. Who else is here? You want to introduce your
Leslie
panel?
Leslie Pollack. I'll start with these three right here. Don,
excuse me, may I ask, if you're speaking to the board, could you please make sure you're in front of the microphone so we can hear you?
I've said those words myself. Yeah. These four are here from Frederick County. Don spoke to you last time, Don Linton, CPA, and was on the first board of trustees. He's been an advocate for the seniors and the good management of these homes for years. His skills are well honed in the management of these facilities.
And are these matters in court right now?
Yes. Leslie can speak to that. That might be what you want to talk to first.
As I recall from our conversations the last time, I think board members were reluctant to vote on a matter that has litigation around it.
Thank you very much.
And your name is?
My name is Leslie Powell. I am the lead attorney in both litigation matters that have been filed in the Frederick County Circuit Court addressing the action of the Board of County Commissioners in its decision to sell the Montague home to a for-profit entity without ensuring that the existing needs of the indigent elderly in Frederick County are being addressed. And this is a very serious issue. We take it, obviously, to heart. Aurora has made clear that it will only provide care to full-pay residents in the private assisted living facility. It's abundantly clear. It's been stated. This property was sold at a loss, a substantial multi-million dollar loss, which will affect the citizens of Frederick County in term, and it's going to affect their taxes, as well as the human costs of no longer having a facility that's available to meet the needs of the poor that cannot provide for it. There is no funding for this. Frankly, what's happening here is it's a rearrangement of tax obligations. Tax obligations are going to increase, and perhaps it's just get it off my bottom line and we'll put it onto the states. But certainly these people need to be taken care of as part of our obligation as citizens of this country. This facility was sold in direct opposition to the Board of Trustees of a citizens' nursing home. It was sold without regard to the opinions of the Commission on Aging for Frederick County. And at least one commissioner at the public hearing acknowledged that there was a need for more services, not fewer. The hearing, frankly, was a complete sham. The vote was in. The evidence, frankly, didn't exist. No studies were undertaken to address the public need or public use component of this facility. And when one sells public property, certainly that's an issue that needs to be addressed. Is there a need for the public use property? And that didn't happen here. Frankly, this is less than 1% of the Frederick County budget when it's not operating well, when it's not operating with the subsidization that can come from the nursing home side to pay for the assisted living facility side. Less than 1%. It's not a lot of money. What we are asking this board... I'm sorry, sir.
I'm going to make a motion. I appreciate what you're saying. It pains me because I'd like to take the $200,000 check. But I think until litigation's resolved, the board should defer action on this item. And I would so move. I take it you would support that.
Thank you very much.
Second.
Treasurer seconds. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. All opposed? That's it. We're going to postpone this, Mr. President, until the court actions are
I appreciate that. I just wish someone would have told me that to save me my time and trouble, but we will be moving forward.
We don't make the decision before the meeting.
But we will be moving forward towards a close, regardless, in December, and I will be transferring the employees to the private company. The private company is already running in that facility, and we will be moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your patience today. All right, final matter, and this long agenda item, I mean long DB, Board of Public Works agenda item are the items on 7S and 17S. Is that right?
Yes.
On pages 19B and 56B, just to thoroughly confuse you.
Governor, these two items are related. Item 7.
I'm sorry. Secretary Maynard, you wanted to correct something for the record back on this was back on what was the appendix?
A9, I believe.
On 7 and 9, was it appendix item 7 and 9,
yes.
Or was it just 9?
Just 9, I believe.
Just 9. Secretary Maynard?
Governor, my apologies to the board. I made a statement that was not correct. I said that the security chief at BCDC was terminated and facing federal charges. I don't have any knowledge that she is facing federal charges. I just misspoke and wanted to correct the record.
Gotcha. Okay. So how do we correct the record here? That corrects it. That corrects right. Do we need to do any motion to correct the record?
Sir, the emergency reports are simply reporting to the board, and they accepted the report. So we can put a note in the record just as a clarification.
On the item, did you hear what Secretary Maynard just had to say?
I just caught the very tail end of it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was
okay.
On the item 7S.
All right. Well, this was back on 9.
The emergency report.
9A, Secretary Maynard just corrected his record. If there needs to be a motion, I'll make the motion. Second about a controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. Record is corrected. And the statement that the Secretary just underscored, it's directed to be corrected on the record and removed from the record. Okay. Thank you. We now move on to
budget management. We're under Department of Budget Management.
Budget Management. Secretary T. Eloise Foster. Okay.
So, Governor, good afternoon. Just to kind of rehash for item 7 and item 17, they are connected. Item 7 awards multiple contracts to multiple vendors to provide statewide legal representation services for children and adults who are involved in the Maryland Legal Services Program. Within item 7, the contract recommendation that impacts 10 jurisdictions across the state has been appealed to the Board of Contract Appeals, and in light of that, item 17 then provides for legal representation services to be extended while the appeals process is underway. Secretary Ted Dallas is here from DHR. He'll answer any questions, and then we have multiple individuals who have asked to speak on this item.
Okay. Secretary, why don't you tell us about this?
Sure. These contracts are the result of an RFP we had for legal services for vulnerable adults and children in need of assistance.
How much do we spend on that annually?
About $13 to $14 million.
And who are the people that do it?
There are providers throughout the state. Their contracts are awarded by jurisdiction.
Contracts awarded by jurisdiction, $13 to $14 million, and in Baltimore City, who provides those services?
Right now, there are, I think, 7 providers. The proposed contracts that are under protest would take it down to 4.
Mm-hmm. And okay. Keep going.
Sure.
Well, let me just ask, in most of the jurisdictions, the large jurisdictions, Montgomery County, for instance, mm-hmm. there are multiple providers.
Yes, in the 4 largest jurisdictions, there are multiple providers. So the matter before you today is to we're asking that all 24 jurisdictions be awarded for vulnerable adults, and 14 of the 24 jurisdictions for children in need of assistance are awarded today. There are 10 jurisdictions for children in need of assistance that are under protest. We are not asking the board to take action on that other than to extend the existing contracts for 6 months to allow adequate time for the protest to be resolved.
Does anybody here on these matters have any objections to that?
There are numerous. Yes, sir. We have numerous speakers for and against. Perhaps you would like to hear the opposition first, since there is kind of an accommodation to resolve the protest. Perhaps you want to hear the people that are opposing the the accommodation.
Sure. I mean, what I'm hearing is that nobody's objecting to the ones that you're asking be approved today.
There's no protest on the ones we're asking.
Okay. And
that's number 7 is the one that's just the award for the non-protested.
All right, well, let's take that one off the table, shall we?
I just want to hear, because I understand it. They want 2 years, not 6 months or something like that. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
That's back on the deferral. Right?
That would be on 17.
But on this other one, there's no objection to 7. Nobody has any objection to 7.
Not that I know of, sir.
Okay.
We are in the time, we only want the opportunity to clarify that in the time.
If I may ask if you're going to speak, I ask that you come to the podium.
It's okay. So it looks like we're going to hear all about the intertwinement for a while. Go ahead, Mr. Wilhelm.
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry. Let me do this. Before we go to Mr. Wilhelm, I had another couple questions for Secretary Dallas.
Sure.
Was there not, I mean, it's my understanding that you did an RFP for these services for all of the jurisdictions, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you went to, and what prompted that RFP? Were the contracts simply up? Or
the contracts actually haven't been awarded since 2007. The base term has been ended, I think, sometime in 2010. There have been some extensions because there's some protests along the way. This was an effort to complete the RFP process.
The contract in 2007, which was essentially a normal contract, was a 3-year contract with 2 optional extensions.
I believe it had
right?
2-year.
That's the way we normally.
Yes.
So it wasn't. It's not an old contract. It's the way contracts run.
I'm sorry. Could you ask that question again?
Just saying, normally you do have a contract that's a couple of years and then has optional
sure.
extensions. So it's no older than any other ongoing.
Correct.
So this came up. It was time.
It was time to take. Yes.
Okay. And was there a board that a prior board that recommended or that looked over this RFP before it went out?
Before the RFP went out.
Right. Did you have a group that assembled?
The RFP was, you know, publicly advertised. We shared it with and worked with the Foster Care Court Improvement Project. And as we normally did, this followed the same process we did for all previous RFPs, got input. RFP was made public, responses were received, and we awarded according to the criteria of the RFP.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And the bids that came in on this, were they were evaluated in terms of price and also quality?
Yes, they were. RFP standard is best overall value to the state, so there was a technical evaluation and a financial proposal evaluation.
And were there any cost savings in this compared to?
Well, our budget right now is between $13 and $14 million. The proposed awards total somewhere between $13 and $14 million. The final amount depends on the number of cases that you actually have, but mm-hmm. it's about the same amount of money.
Okay, thanks. All right, Mr. Joseph, I should say.
Good morning. Good afternoon, sir. And the board. Governor, before I start, Marianne, I wanted to say that she spoke to me this morning about working for the state for 40 years. I think she has a very serious human rights complaint, because it's obvious if she worked for the state for 40 years, she was hired somewhere around age 3 or 4. And we object to that. And, we have calculated what the state owes her. And we tell you later on. Governor, I can move on. It will not take a long time in our presentation. I'm going to ask 3 lawyers to stand with me. Stella Meyerhoff, Amy, Jack, and Portland, Ruben Ballesteros, and Sherry Hughes. Just stand here. One will speak, and I will speak, and that's it. My friend, I want to commend you for your support of the work we do. In your tenure, you have signed 2 bills that were able to stabilize legal services for poor people in Maryland. Many states had a different experience when interest on lawyer trust accounts went down and cut by 80%. So we have been able in Maryland up to this day not to lay off and reduce our capacity. And even then, only 20% of the folks who need our services to get us. I want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
I want to thank you again for allowing us to use you as a selling point during our 100th anniversary to attract Mr. Harry Belafonte here. We told him you definitely would be there, and you came along with your wife and your father-in-law. I thank you for that. I want to have 2 apologies. 1, at that event, a prominent lawyer who introduced you called you Governor Mandel. And if you recall, you responded with a very funny line. You told your wife, Katie, you came to the dance with Governor Mandel. Well, I'm sorry, you're going home with Governor O'Malley. I'll put up a funny line.
Thank you.
I also want to apologize for snatching you twice the last 2 weeks. The last time being at Ocean City at Mako. Then you're having a good time talking.
It's okay. Hey, I want there to get snatched.
Right.
That's all right.
Okay. All right. So, let's clarify what's happening here with this recommendation. We are not opposing the contracts. We are not opposing the extensions. We are saying, and I have a duty to let you know, we prefer that this board encourage DHR to stick with the terms of a contract that we negotiated back a few years ago. That contract had a three-year-based contract and two successive or consecutive option contracts. It took DHR 13 months after the expiration of the first base contract before it exercised its first option. That ended in February of 2013. Instead of exercising the second option, we are being pressured to sign on to extensions, 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 extensions. And now, today's recommendation involves more extensions, extensions, extensions. We will not talk about the protest. That's there. So I'd like to move on by simply asking 130 to share with you what it is to be a lawyer representing the most vulnerable citizens of this state. Children who have been abused terribly and neglected. And to try to impress upon you why it's important to have lawyers who do a comprehensive, intensive, sensitive job of representing these children. And that we don't buy into a course of direction that goes for the cheapest lawyer on the block. I call upon Amy to protest. She's a lawyer, 7 years here in Maryland. She works out of Montgomery County. And we just built or just rented a very new space to serve that county. Seven lawyers, we have 11 lawyers there. Four of them who still don't work. If this thing goes forward, as the secretary proposes, four of those lawyers will lose their jobs. Dr. Sherry Jones, she practices in Montgomery County. How many years?
I've been with Legal Aid for
15 years. Ruben Ballesteros from Montgomery County. How many years, Ruben? 17 years. And Sarah Barra, as a volunteer lawyer, all volunteer work, doing similar work only. How many years?
10.
10 and a half.
Good afternoon. My name is Amy Petkosik, and I have spent the past 7 years working for an organization that has fully empowered my zealous representation of Maryland's most vulnerable citizens. Currently, as an attorney in Legal Aid Montgomery County office, I fight for children without a voice, to be free from harm, to be educated with their peers, and to embrace a future they have always feared. I represent a young woman who was sent to another country so that her sexual orientation would be forcibly raped out of her. And I fought a multiple-day trial that successfully allowed her to live here in her nation free of fear. In the coming months, if this Board of Public Works permits Legal Aid to continue its work in this arena, I will continue my client's journey as I voice her pursuit of human rights to the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. I have utilized Legal Aid's resources to help young adults raised by the state for years to prepare for adulthood, specifically using other Maryland Legal Aid Bureau attorneys to help with her wrongful discharge employment case. I have employed the resources in the newly opened expansive Legal Aid office in Montgomery County to assist a 17-year-old with her Social Security disability incomes benefits. I've used my familiarity with the Spanish language to allow rape victims to feel more at ease telling their stories, and have employed language line services to help my Hispanic clients with more advanced issues. Specifically, I have spent over 600 hours in the past 3 years representing six siblings, all under the age of seven, who were brutally sexually abused by their parents. After 15 days of trial and three trips to the Court of Special Appeals, four of the six children now reside in permanent homes. The oldest two girls continue to have extensive mental health needs, requiring my advocacy at monthly treatment team conferences, court appearances, and home visits, leading the judge presiding over their case to remark that at one point the girls' closest attachment was to their attorney. Many members of the girls' current treatment team have remarked that the loss of their legal aid attorney due to the pending contract decision would devastate my clients and silence their voices. The holistic nature of the cases I work on cannot be understated. It is only by immersing myself in the educational, vocational, therapeutic, and residential areas of my clients' lives that I am able to zealously voice their needs and seek the services they deserve. I have passionately represented over 400 youth, including fighting the Department of Human Resources in our appellate courts and testifying to reframe legislation in the best interest of Maryland's children. always with the full support of the Legal Aid Bureau. It was never going above and beyond. It was always exactly what Maryland's children deserved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dear Board, I will conclude. I wish I had time to tell you lots of stories, but I will tell you a vignette. That's part fiction and part real, because I'll try to tie into this 1 minute many aspects of the work of senior lawyers and in need of these children. Three children, three beautiful young children, blue-eyed and blonde, arrives in the court. And Miss Amy, the lawyer, hears the story. There were three or four children who came from an Eastern European country. And they are in court because they are now going to go into care. Their youngest sibling, Boris, was murdered by the parents. So the oldest one, Katrina, Maria, and Dimitri are in the court. Attorney Amy takes the case, and they are sent to a foster home. In that foster home, Katrina, the oldest, she likes to read. Maria, the middle one, wants to be a lawyer or a doctor. And Dimitri likes computers. Katrina overhears a discussion between the social worker and the foster home owner. And the foster home owner is complaining about the lack of resources from the state to adequately take care of these children. And the social worker admits that she is overworked and she does not have enough resources, and her salary puts her in a tough position. And she tells them both, and she tells this to Lawyer Amy. And Lawyer Amy said, "We'll try our best to make things out for you." And lo and behold, in the midst of this, the verdict is rendered, and their mother and father have been convicted of murder, and they'll be going to jail for a long time. And lo and behold, the state begins proceedings to terminate their parental rights. And Katrina says, "Wait a minute. Yes, she killed Boris, but I may have something to say about it. Can I go to the TPR hearing?" He's told, "No, the law does not allow a single child to speak at a TPR hearing." And Amy says, "I will fight for you to get the right to go to court." And Amy takes that case all the way to the Court of Appeals and wins the right for that child to speak at the termination hearing, and she speaks. And lo and behold, by the dealing with that, 16-year-old Dimitri gets himself in trouble with the law. He's charged with possession of marijuana and vandalism in the county. And Miss Amy said, "I don't do those cases, but I will go with you. I will work with your public defender to help them understand your traumatic circumstances under which you live." And she helps. And lo and behold, while she's dealing with that, Katrina said, "I'm pregnant. And the baby is born." And now she has to work with the social workers to get her housing, benefits, help. That's a real life situation. The lawyer is doing all of this. And the lawyer shares a story. "I have clients out of state. I must visit from time to time. And the state does not pay me extra for that. But I go, because I'm a legal aid lawyer. And when I can't go to see that child, because I'm busy in court, I send a legal aid paralegal. And when Christmas comes along, and Thanksgiving, legal aid invites these children in to give gifts to them so they have a normal holiday." This is the life of a legal aid lawyer. So, I end with a very simple statement. It's a proverb that I heard as a little boy growing up in Trinidad. And it said, "You know, a cheap thing is no good, and a good thing is not cheap." What I would like this board to do is to encourage the department to establish a task force or a committee in the interim to look into the best practices of how you procure a lawyer, particularly for little children, where quality and competence carries more weight than the lowest price. I shudder to think that I or a kid is going to be fully represented as a judge for $800 a year in Baltimore City. It's frightening. And that provider is ranked number one. That's why I asked you, Governor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Joseph.
Governor, could I just ask Ms. Meyerhoff, Sarah Meyerhoff, if you could just come up and tell us exactly what you or your organization would like to have happen with these two. Both, I guess there are two of them that are intertwined somehow.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues where in Baltimore County we were ranked technically number one. We didn't get the contracts. So to me, I don't understand.
But the two items before us, Ms.
Okay, the two specifically.
Yeah.
But I was really here just to talk about my experiences, and I think they were well articulated that these cases are much more complex than just simple three hearings and you're done, but that our office offers a plethion of services, whether it has to do with housing or whatever, that we never drop a case. We keep it for a number of years. Often these kids come in at 5 or 6, and we're with them till 21. So we are a check on ensuring that these children receive all services available to them. And every state struggles with the economies of how to provide children with everything they need.
Could I interrupt? I hear that.
Yeah.
And I heard
okay.
that.
And I think you did.
I would like to ask the secretary. Where did the secretary go? Back there. I am remiss. I don't have a copy of the RFP. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I hear is the factors that go into good representation in CINA cases. It's not simply taking a case and being, but the network, the ongoing service, et cetera. Was that articulated in the RFP?
Those are articulated in the technical portion of the RFP, yes.
So the assumption is that all the things that were laid out were, in fact, back and read the RFP, will I hear what these
I haven't met the particular lawyers that spoke here today, but
most of us have been around and know what goes into center representation.
And I'm sure if you talk to the other providers, and all the providers that we awarded contracts to are all existing providers with the department. They all have a minimum of 14 years of experience providing services to kids.
I'm not asking that. I guess I'd like to see a copy of the RFP.
Sure.
I think part of it has to do with the weight that you give to the pricing.
The weight you give
to the pricing is very high from the beginning, even if you're number one technically.
I get that.
Well, I would be happy to move things along, Madam Treasurer and Governor, and urge that the item 17, which I take it is the one with the 6 month versus 2 year, that the agency take advantage of the 2 year option and come back and see us later on that. The first item sounds to me, I'm just not clear what that ought to happen to that, but I'd be happy to make that motion just for discussion's sake. And Mr. Secretary, it doesn't sound like you're saving a lot of money one way or the other.
No, I mean, we had an RFP that was conducted under the rules that were advertised. There's no reason to extend the contracts for 2 years. We've had a fair RFP. So Legal Aid did very well in the RFP process. They had the second highest number of cases in the entire state were awarded to them. They have, at the end of the day, the contracts we're awarding to them are going to total today, just the ones that aren't in dispute, are $3.8 million. And if they're not successful in the protest, they'll get another $3.2 million for a total of $7 million, even if they are not successful in the protest. So they came in, they got the silver medal. They had the second highest number of cases.
Yes. Mr. Secretary, but honestly, I mean, this is not a Apple or AT&T or something that's missing out on a contract. This is an incredibly important organization. I'm not saying you can't save money. I'm all for that. But
contracts don't save money.
Yeah, it just sounds like you're breaking something up for... And as I said, I mean, you can't just stand up and say this. They came in second and they got a silver medal if it disrupts the service that they're providing. And I'm not real... I don't know. This is a long day. Whatever the treasurer and the governor wants, I'd love to be supportive of. But it certainly sounds like legal aid is having a lot of pressure put on them, which is on top of everything else. In other words, this is a service that they're providing the state. We're compensating them, and then we're saying, by the way, we want you to really go on a probationary basis because we think we can bid this out. And I would just extend the thing for 2 years and go with that. Thank you.
We were technically ranked number one in Baltimore County, but we didn't get the contract, which doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry.
I don't think it's just dollars and cents here. Normal procurement.
This decision was made based on a review of the technical proposals and the financial proposals. There is no pressure being put on legal aid. There's no six-month probationary period. Right now, we have an RFP. Right, we have contracts that no one is protesting that we'd like to have awarded, and complete the RFP process for that. For the ones that are under protest, all we're asking is that the current contracts, the status quo, be held for 6 months to allow the Contract Board of Appeals to hear the appeal.
Yeah. Well, I know they're technical and pricing issues. How about the human issues? I mean, really? I mean, this whole thing, I don't know. I don't want to get too far out on this, but it just seems that this is a very difficult area of legal service. And, boy, if it's not broke, why are we fixing this? Why didn't we just go and do the – I mean, all the time I see options taken. All the for-profit companies, it's just, automatic. You know, you want a 10-year extension? No problem, as long as it's in the contract. And this is in the contract, but we're going out and bringing in all sorts of new lawyers, some of whom may be great, some of whom may not be great.
They're not new lawyers. They're existing lawyers that we have in the system right now. They're just different providers getting more cases than we have right now. But in reference to your argument about why don't we just take the extension years, I have been in this room many times where, you know, departments have been admonished about simply awarding option years. I do not believe in simply awarding option years.
Name one time.
That I was here?
Yeah. I don't remember a single one.
I was. There was one involving DHR that was our IT contracts that, you know, it was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. There's one on the board today where we asked a question about why we awarded an option year for our vehicle program instead of going out to bidding. It's a conversation that's there. But the competitive process is there to make sure the state gets the best overall value for its dollar. And we're just issuing an RFP. It's part of the process. There are RFPs that are issued all the time.
Okay. Sir, there are two more speakers that signed up in support of legal aid, and there are four speakers that signed up in support of the agenda items as proposed.
All right, so Mr. DeShields and Mr. Andrews, let's hear from you on since we started with legal aid.
Good afternoon, Governor, Mr. Franchot, Secretary, and the Treasurer Cobb. My name is Robert DeShields. I am I'm an attorney representing one of three law firms who I think are probably among those in the state who do more procurement work than any others. And we're all here supporting Maryland Legal Aid Free. I've been here for a long time. Phil has been here for a long time. Neither of us is charging a penny for this. And we're all here to ask you to do one simple thing, and that essentially is what the comptroller just recommended, to have the department simply exercise the remaining option on the contract. Madam Treasurer, yes, there is a technical component of the proposal. It is weighted 50%. It's given just as much weight, price is given just as much weight as technical, but you can't. This is not that kind of deal. It's not that kind of service. If you don't have the kind of passion that Wilhelm Joseph just indicated, there aren't enough dollars available to do the service that's required, particularly in the jurisdictions that are in dispute. I'm asking you to end the dispute. I'm asking you to end the protest by directing the department to exercise the option, and let's figure out the best way. If you really think that competition is needed,
If somebody who's been doing it 102 years and the benefit of all of that versus somebody who just created in 2001, if you really think competition is needed, let's figure out the best way to do it. This is not the best way. Thank you so much.
Is there not a commission or legislative group that is looking at how service contracts are awarded?
If I may, Madam Treasurer, there is a legislative council for the procurement of health, education, and social services. The treasurer is a member. Suzanne sits on that council. It does report to the Board of Public Works. While its mandate does not necessarily include legal services, if the board thinks it's appropriate, perhaps that council could study this particular issue and report back to the board.
And who is, does that include?
It includes the agencies, it includes legislative representative and provider organizations.
Thank you.
Mr. Andrews?
Thank you, Governor. Philip Andrews on behalf of Legal Aid. I cannot be more eloquent than Mr. DeShiel or Mr. Joseph. What I can tell the board, I think the board has heard me on a number of times, this is a different kind of service than the other procurements that come before this board. And I would simply urge the board, exercise the option, because the alternative is continue litigation, contract claims, and the rest of it. The option is the way to go. It keeps the continuity and the expertise of Legal Aid in place. That's the contract term should include that, and that's what we urge the board to do. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'm also very aware it's been a long day.
Just ask one more. The difference between this contract and the prior ones is the proportion of weight given to technical versus financial? I mean,
yes.
Is that the main?
Actually, Madam Treasurer, this current procurement that's before you has had kind of a checkered history, because the first attempt to figure out how the factors would be considered was actually came out as an IFB, an invitation for bids, and Legal Aid protested that and said we're not buying widgets, you can't just have it purely on price.
And that was different than predecessor.